very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding?
Yes.
Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5:10. Apologies for the late start. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 16th of August 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, which, along with London's Inner Temple and Edinburgh's Roslyn Chapel, is one of several little templar zones in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqeueuk.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and not Google Play. And by the way, late night tonight, all of those little, well, they're not little, they're usually quite a few of them, and longer clips. So if there's any of the interviews that you find interesting by some miracle today in today's program, you can go and listen to generally to longer versions, up to an hour or so, maybe an hour and a half even, where we're just going to be playing a little clip of them. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions. Now what you're listening to is something like the BBC might have been if Victor Rothschild hadn't nobbled Alistair Milne back in 1987, which I remember well. I joined the BBC in 1989, a couple of years after, so I witnessed the destruction from within that was wielded by a guy called John Burt. Puff pieces they do nowadays on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. It's like a gigantic great advertising machine on every news bulletin. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III and wage slavery lies. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months. Twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies craftily crafted to make every crisis worse. Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones. The cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their machines. I should call him Nazi Nick, of course, really, which was his nickname at school. Albert Pike, I sound like a public schoolboy. Martin would be very annoyed if I was. No, this is just a normal, boring old 1970s grammar school. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Camilla wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS through their latest glove puppets, which look like what crawled out of the recycling bin, panda-eyed energy saboteur secretary Ed Miliband. Anyway, helping us navigate through the accelerationist WEF's Fourth Reich matrix is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and former British Army soldier Warren Thornton. Today we'll be hearing a bit from Kevin Cahill about the King, all sorts of interesting stuff about the Crown Estates and the cover-ups there, and Murdoch too, in one of the most difficult Zoom calls I've ever done in my life. Somehow remotely Kevin's microphone kept getting switched off as we were doing the Zoom call, and then eventually he was trying to switch it on again and Zoom wouldn't respond at all. So it's funny, we were talking all at the time about the way that the King appoints army officers and judges and things like that, just, and it all went wrong. Anyway, you'll hear quite a bit of that before it went wrong, and even part of it when it did get wrong, because I was recording it off the phone too. That's Kevin Cahill. And also in part two, we've got Peter Ford, deputy leader of George Galloway's Workers' Party, talking about both Ukraine and about what's been going on in Israel. Iranian and Russian news censored in UK by the telecoms cartel. By the way, I mustn't forget Wafa Aludaini, another report from her from Gaza this week. Brilliant. Well done, Wafa, for getting that through. Amazing that sometimes these reports do get through from her. The BBC don't have anyone in Gaza, but not the BCFM politics show certainly does. Maybe they don't want to, eh? And the telecoms cartel, and then also by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and also from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft by the trans lobby. So, Warren, I'll just welcome you first. Can you just give the audience who are not familiar with you a little bit of a brief outline of how you came from soldier to journalist?
Yes, I was a military sniper for 6 years in the British Army. I then spent 8 years in war-torn areas looking after aid workers. And, of course, you got to know military intelligence people who were seconded to the embassies. And, of course, they weren't there for, that country. They were there for their own interests. You got to know journalists. You got to know embassy staff. And you got to know military intelligence analysts. They kept phoning me up and saying, you've got to tell somebody about this. We can't, because we'll lose our jobs or something worse. So that's how I got into it. And, of course, I was the journalist responsible for breaking the Nazi in the Canadian Parliament story.
Now, what about the journalists that you have spoken to over the years? Why do you think, what's your analysis? And we've had the arrest briefly of Scott Ritter last week in the US. They're accusing him of being an agent of the Russians for taking money from RT. But why is it that when people, journalists, freelancers, etc., will phone up the mass media, mostly based in London, and say, we've got a story here, that half the time they don't want to listen?
No, absolutely, and that is because the oligarchs who basically own the press, started with Don McCullin way back when he was doing the war photography on Vietnam, and I remember talking to him and him saying that he submitted some pictures to the Daily Telegraph. This was back in the 90s, and they said no thank you very much, and pretty much terminated his contract. Journalists now will follow whatever line they're told to by the editors, and that includes obviously television journalism as well. And when those people are owning the stations and owning everything that you do there, pretty much you're going to be out of a job if you don't toe the party line. That's the trouble. I think it was best said by Network, wasn't it, when Peter Finch, the actor, stood up and he said, when the top corporations own the largest propaganda machine in the world, we're all in a lot of trouble.
I remember him getting everybody in the country to get up onto open their windows, go onto their balconies, and go on to, or go into their gardens, whatever, and yell along with the TV, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm just not going to take it anymore." I can remember in that film, it's Network, you're right. There's this wonderful picture of all these people, families outside, just getting fed up but listening to the TV at the same time. Another really good one around that same era was that film They Live, which is all about a kind of group of aliens who have managed to use the TV to basically hypnotise people, and they've got a special signal which means that they can be concealed, and Roddy Piper and his mates then go and blast that. Anyway, less reminiscing about films. Another one, good one's 3 Days of the Condor, which popped up in conversation this week. One of the greatest Robert Redford films ever, I think.
Yes, I'll just add a quick rider to that. When he was saying about Peter Finch gets everybody to lean out of the window and shout out, "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." Exactly the same thing happened in the pandemic with going down and banging pots and pans.
Oh, God. Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, that was in a sort of negative fashion. Anyway, look, we've got you on really this week to talk a bit about Kursk. I know, and having spoken to Kevin Carr, who was a former soldier himself from the Sunday Times earlier this week, he pointed out to me in this longer interview, which was a very strange Zoom interview, which his microphone kept getting remotely switched off somewhere along the way, that actually Kursk was very important in the Second World War. Now, a lot of people talk about Stalingrad as the big turning point, and I would agree with that, but when it comes to the end of the war and the pursuit of the Nazis by the Russians, really without much help from the British and the Americans, the Allies, the Western Front hadn't even opened at that point, this Kursk battle was very important, in the stage where the Russians were starting to advance towards Germany, and the question was, would the would the Germans be able to, you know, knock out a load of their tanks and throw them back, wasn't it? Can you just tell us a bit about this World War II Kursk battle?
Yeah, it was the largest tank battle in history, and for anybody who's a student of that and has looked at it, it was seen as though the Russians couldn't win, and of course the Russians did win this tank battle. And of course that was really the breaking of the back of the German advance and the German superiority. And finally, people began to realize that this German machine was stoppable. And I mean, as a propaganda victory and a victory for morale, it probably did more than the actual people who took part in it. It inspired millions, even though, you know, thousands only took part in it, but it inspired millions of people really to greater efforts against Nazi Germany. It really was, for me, Stalingrad. You're right, everybody talks about Stalingrad, but without Kursk, Stalingrad would have never happened.
Martin, what do you make of the significance of Kursk in this part, this region, or this area in Russia now having been, there's a salient, as of last week, in fact, the Ukrainian troops seem to be staying put?
Well, obviously, the battle in World War II, Stalingrad was essentially a defensive battle. Kursk started off as a defensive battle, but it became an offensive battle, and it became clear that, you know, there was only one thing going to happen, which was Nazi Germany was going to lose. So obviously, you know, that would obviously inspire partisans in places like Greece and Yugoslavia and so on to greater efforts, as Warren's just said. What's happened now is kind of, you know, what's it Mark said, history is repeated first as tragedy and then as farce. I'm quite sure it's a propaganda exercise by the Ukrainians probably working with Western intelligence services.
Hang on, Martin, because it's not really just propaganda, is it? This is a whole load of troops on the ground in Russia causing all sorts of trouble there.
It's an escalation politically to go into Russia like that, but at the same time, from a military point of view, it's got no real purpose because they're being hammered down in the Donbass where the real battle is, and they've pulled some of their top elite forces, their only reserves they've got, out of the mainstream thing to throw them in here. And of course they've got no logistics. The Russians are going to seal them off and they won't get out. I mean, if they don't surrender, they're all going to die. So I think most people who've seriously looked at it can see that it's a desperate throw of the dice. And of course it's linked also to this recent story in the Wall Street Journal about how it supposedly Zaluzhny, the general who was in charge previously, picked out to become ambassador to Britain, he supposedly signed off on the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by a load of people in a yacht. I mean, all of this stuff is desperate stuff in terms of PR. But
it's not just PR, Martin. You get off of this thing of PR, please, because this is a military, actually a successful military victory. It may have left them thin on the ground in other parts, but, you know, this is causing all sorts of trouble for the Russians. I wonder if we could maybe talk, Warren, about, the Russian RT, which is so-called blocked here in the UK. I'll put a link up to this on our show page, of course, at thisweek.org.uk. The UK trained Ukrainian soldiers before the Kursk attack. British instructors showed Kiev's troops how to raid high-rise buildings that the newspaper has reported. That's the Times. And actually, this is really, I suppose, it's not RT, it's the Times. Some of Kiev's troops underwent training in the UK shortly before the Ukrainian incursion into Russia's Kursk region. The Times has reported on August the 6th, Ukrainian forces launched their largest attack on Russian territory. Kiev has utilised some of the Ukraine's most battle-hardened fighters, and the British paper said in an article on Friday that some of them have been trained in Britain. So I'll put a link up to this, as I said, but I just happened to be down in Imber on Salisbury Plain, I think it was last weekend or maybe the weekend before, wandering around some of the blockhouses there. There's loads of Ukrainian graffiti in there. So it looks as if we have just been training for this specific operation, maybe, Warren.
There's a couple of things that people are sort of missing here. First of all, yes, it is big propaganda for them because obviously they took over. But it's not just the propaganda aspect. They wanted to get to the nuclear reactor in Kursk. There's now a cauldron there. The numbers that are dead, you've got over 2,000, almost 3,000 now Ukrainians dead, 188 Russians. You've got 63 civilians, including two doctors and a pregnant woman, which doesn't do a great deal for you. And let's not forget, if they could have got to the Kursk nuclear power plant, they need something to go to the negotiating table with, and nobody's really talking about this. You don't negotiate from a position of weakness, sorry. You negotiate from a position of strength. Now, had they been able to capture Kursk nuclear power plant, and don't get me wrong, they're several tens of kilometres away from it, it might have been different. Now, they were trained by Britain. They also had Polish in there as well, because we've seen, I've got pictures of Polish dead mercenaries in the forest in Kursk. The problem is, this was doomed to fail from the start. If you're going to have a huge punch like this through, and they did catch the Russians on the hop. Let's face it, it's embarrassing. Are they at the moment on Ukraine, on Russian soil? Yes, they are. Are they getting sort of pounded and wasted on Russian soil? Yes, they are. And the thing is, if you go and have a look at the map of the general area and look at the overall picture, there's this bubble again, like there was in Bakhmut, like there was in Adiivka, and of course they keep filling it up with troops, they keep getting wiped out. And Martin is right that they are taking people from other areas and they're losing massive ground elsewhere. If it's a propaganda exercise, it's a terrible, terrible thing, and it's cost many, many lives. If it was a genuine attempt to get hold of the Kursk nuclear power plant, which was some 23 kilometres away when they were finally ground to a halt, as a negotiating tactic, then that would make more sense for me.
So let's have a listen now to what Vladimir Putin had to say earlier this week. Now, I did have a look around on the internet, on YouTube, etc., to see if I could find Putin's speech. No, nowhere. There was a 3 or 4 second clip which was used by the BBC. So let's have a listen to what Vladimir Putin actually had to say about this whole invasion of Kursk by the Ukrainians earlier this week, when he was chatting to some of his governors of the various regions of Russia in that part of the country.
Colleagues, good afternoon. In the Bryansk region, in the Belgorod and the Kursk region, the estimate of the following events must be provided, and it will be done. But the most important thing right now is to address the relevant issues that are unfolding at this moment and based on the estimates of the situation as it unfolds in the future. Now, the priority for us is for the Ministry of Defense to drive the enemy out of our territories, and working together with the border forces to make sure that our state borders are safely secured. The Federal Security Service, together with the Russian Guard, with Rosgvardia, must engage in a counter-terrorist operation and fight the groups of the enemy. And Rosgvardia has its own missions at hand as well. Now, civilian agencies must make sure that our troops are provided with everything that's necessary. I'm not going to list everything, but transportation, in the industry, construction, medicine, and financial matters, all this must be addressed. Now, the heads of the corresponding regions must prioritize. The main goal is to support our people that require help and protection.
Right, so you first, Martin, what do you make of what Putin's saying there?
Well, he's just saying steady the buffs, isn't he? We know we've got this under control, but we need to work together. It's a sort of, you know, a sort of business-like sort of a speech. But, of course, it's being presented in the Western media, The Guardian, for example, today. They're going about, you know, Putin's on the back foot. What will he do now? Because, of course, the whole purpose of this is is they're pushing this idea that if they carry out terrorist attacks like the Crocus attack or this stuff attacking Russia itself, that the Russian population will rise up and get rid of Putin and say, why did you let this happen? It's just a total misreading of the situation, because as Putin pointed out in another part of the speech, we're actually getting more people signing up to go and fight in this war as a result of this incursion into Russian territory. So in that sense, it's totally self-defeating.
Warren, we'll hear from you after we hear a bit more from Vladimir Putin.
Now, before we move on to work and give the floor to the speakers, I'd like to say a few words more. Now, it seems obvious right now why the Kyiv regime refused our proposals to go back to a peaceful resolution. And just also why they denied any peaceful intermediaries from engaging in this conversation. The Ukrainian government is following the will of the West, and its masters in the West. It's the West that's fighting us using the hands of the Ukrainians. They're trying to improve their negotiating positions in the future. But what negotiations could we even talk about with people who are attacking civilians, civilian infrastructure, or trying to create threats or nuclear industry facilities? What is there to even talk about with them? Now, number two, operations like these have a military goal to stop our troops from fully liberating the Donetsk and Lugansk territories in Novorossiya. Now, what do we see happening on the front lines, on the line of contact? In fact, the speed at which our forces, our troops are progressing in those areas is in fact almost 1.5 times higher than before. Our troops are advancing. And one more obvious goal of the enemy is to sow dissent in our society, to threaten people, to make them afraid, to shatter the unity of our society, to try to attack us politically. But even in that respect, we have a response too. We see that our people are supporting one another, they're supporting their armed forces, and we see that more and more volunteers are coming to join our soldiers, our men who are fighting with arms in their hands, to defend their motherlands. We see more and more contracts being signed by people wishing to join the military.
Actually, Martin, you preempted Putin there. Yes, quite right. He's saying more people are joining, but I mean, he could be lying. That could be propaganda. Anyway, Warren, what do you make of the what he's saying there?
He's pretty much spot on. You are not going to beat them. It really is going to be a bit of a problem for the West, because Washington do tend to live in a bit of a bubble. And of course, they think they can win. They're not having to put any troops up there. It's just a military-industrial complex, which they, all the senators in America get handsomely compensated by, and do quite a few, shall we say, public speaking engagements. So of course, they're happy. They're not. There's no American troops on the ground that they're admitting to, and of course, there are American mercs who are getting wiped out every day. Putin is completely right. They see Putin as not only a political leader, but a spiritual one as well. And you always fight harder for a spiritual leader. It's not the same in the UK or anywhere else. Are you going to sign up to go and fight for Biden? No. Are you going to sign up to go and fight for Starmer? No. We've got a fight on our hands in Great Britain as it is with Starmer, let alone going and fighting somewhere else. Are you going to fight for Macron? Of course you're not. You're going to fight for Trudeau. So the West is in a real quandary here because there are people signing up more and more to go and defend their motherland. It's the same as if you do a terrorist attack, say, in another country where you go and blow up somebody's street. You may kill one or two people, but you create another 10 people that want to, you know, somebody says, I'll put a weapon in your hand, you want to go and fight these evil monsters. We go and do that, don't we? And that's how terrorists are created. And these terrorist attacks, I mean, they blew up a supermarket today in Donetsk, the Ukrainians. I mean, this is just going to make Russians more angry and more willing to go and fight for Putin. It seems a really self-defeating and idiotic move by the West, but we don't seem to know any other way of trying to get some sort of result here.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think it is self-defeating for the West. I mean, they're slowly but surely ploughing through thousands of young, tens of thousands of young men from Ukraine, and this is a proxy war. Anyway, before we hear from Martin, let's just have a listen to the last of the three clips of Putin from this speech, and I'll put a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, plus a little bit of chit chat with some of the governors of the various oblasts around Kursk.
Now, the Kyiv regime is not only perpetrating a crime against us, against national law, but they're in fact on a path to destroy their own Ukrainian people. The losses of the Ukrainian armed forces have been increasing dramatically, including among the most battle-ready groups of Ukrainian armed forces that they are sending to our borders. Now, the enemy will be thwarted, and the goals that we have set will certainly be met.
So that's the end of Putin's speech. Martin, look, at the end of the day here, they've made a big mistake, the Russians, haven't they, in that, you know, they're arresting troops every few weeks. They're on the front line for a while, then they go back behind. These soldiers should have been sitting there waiting with anti-tank weapons and stuff, even if they are resting, in case something like this happened, so that they could just take out vehicles if they tried to, you know, but their line was far too thin.
Well, obviously, the historians will have to look into this when they look at the records on both sides.
But it was, wasn't it? What I just said is true, isn't it? The line was far too thin, and there were no sort of contingencies for a breakthrough by the Ukrainians. The Russians didn't even consider it. This is quite a serious military failure, really.
Some of the stuff I've been reading, Tony, like from Pepe Escobar today, he's been talking to the Russian military intelligence people about what happened, and there's one theory that's running around that they removed the minefield in front because it was very heavily mined, and the Russians actually removed their own minefields. And the suspicion, this is one of the theories that's being put around there, is that in actual fact this is a trap, and that the Ukrainians have walked straight into it because this is their final reserves. And they've committed them to a trap because none of them are going. They're all going to be killed or captured now, and they haven't got any other reserves. Which means that as soon as the Ukrainian army collapses, which could happen quite quickly now, because this is all the reserves they've got, the Russians can go and take anything they want in the Ukraine because there'll be nothing there to stop them. And don't forget, if you've massed a load of forces there, the Chechen commander was saying, because they only had light forces there, their special forces, this was 12,000 troops with tanks and everything. So if you'd massed enough to stop them, that would have come under attack. One of the problems with modern warfare is that you can't mass big forces together very easily without them being spotted. The Ukrainians, I've been reading a lot about this, the Ukrainians were only told the day before that they were going to do this. So they've kept it all very secret. They've taken all these people, thrust them through the supposed hole in the line. But of course, it means it's a big change in policy because you're actually invading Russian territory now. Now, it's undoubtedly the case that British mercenaries are in there with the Ukrainians invading Russian territory. Now, at some point, that's going to trigger responses to Britain because the Russians see the British as being in particular behind these kind of maneuvers. because the British, and of course British Challenger tanks, have both been incinerated. I've seen the videos of that. As soon as they're attacked by Lancet drones, they get wiped out and they blow up. They don't, because of the way they keep the ammunition. And of course that's the last thing that the British military wanted to see, is their best tanks being blown to pieces by $2,000.
Let's get Warren's view on that. Warren's
signed off, Tony. He's gone.
Okay. So that's a pity, because it would be nice to have asked him about that, about the credibility or otherwise that the Russians have deliberately allowed this to take place. I know, Martin. We all know that. So you don't even need to say it. That this is conjecture. We're looking at speculative conjecture about what's going on. That they may have known about it beforehand. And I mean, I don't know if you remember last week, we were saying that the Russians seem to be taking a quite leisurely approach to this. Now, that may be propaganda, but it may be because they knew exactly what was going to happen and they were prepared to deal with it. Anyway, I'm also joined in the studio by Martin Smith. Martin, would you like to just come up to the mic and introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Martin Smith. I've been a band the bomber since 1958. Very interested in wars and conflicts. As a child, I saw some pictures of Bergen-Belsen, and later on as a filmmaker, I saw more, and I was convinced at the time that the human race can be willing to do anything, to kill, to starve, to murder, to kill. This especially worried me when the nuclear weapons started to be heavily developed in the 50s. Bertrand Russell said this is crazy, and I became part of the Ban the Bomb movement. And I did my leafleting, I did the writing the letters, I handed out things at meetings and so on, did an awful lot. I was also a member of the Direct Action Committee Against Nuclear War, who stood outside Aldermaston long before the first Aldermaston March. I served with CND. I became a member of the Committee of 100 when, after several years, we didn't seem to be getting enough attention, and I was one of the people who sat down on various demonstrations, and I ended up spending 2 months in Her Majesty's prison sewing mailbags. That was in 1962. But then I thought, well, of all these years, 4 years I've been doing it, are they wasted? I don't think they have, because in 1963 we had a partial test ban treaty, and the world was at least now willing to listen to the idea that nuclear war was terrible. I stopped then doing very much, because I thought, well, I've played my propaganda hard, it's time to earn a living. I went in and became a documentary filmmaker. Since then, I've made more films than I care to remember. One of the most noticeable one was Episode 11 of The World at War, which ended with the removal of the German army from Kursk and the big tank battle in Kursk. I've followed a whole lot of things since then. I was the series producer of a 24-hour series with CNN and the BBC on the Cold War. Took all the various through. So I'm very interested in the thing, and having heard some of the things you've just been broadcasting, I thought, what a lot of codswallop. I mean, it was Russia that did the invasion of Ukraine territory whose boundaries that they'd recommended. It's a war by Putin, which he was expected to take Ukraine within weeks. The war, reasons for the war, we can war on forever, but he didn't succeed. The Ukrainians have hold on remarkably. Sure, everybody's signing up in Russia. You defend, you do your bit. The Germans did their bit for Adolf, and the Italians did their bit for Mussolini. If you fly the nationalist flag loud enough, you can get people to do all sorts of things.
So why is it that British tanks are now rolling into Russia?
Well, because they are part of a Western aim which believes that the boundaries of states should be held and stayed, and that the Russians should not gain any more territory. And if they are in Russia now, one doesn't know the precise reason why the Ukes have gone in at this point, but it seems to me, and you look at it in realpolitik terms, if there is to be talks about the future, then sitting on a few square miles of Russian territory can be part of a bargaining. People will get killed, yes. I mean, it's for the Ukrainians to decide as much as they can what they do. Certainly, the Ukrainians are now part and parcel of the old Cold War.
Are they in NATO? I mean, we might at some point be seeing Russian tanks coming into Britain.
Well, of course, the whole war goes back to the situation of, was NATO expanding too much? But then why was NATO expanding? NATO was expanding because the Baltic states and others in Eastern Europe desperately wanted to join because they did not trust the Russians not to come in and bowl them out of the way, which was exactly what the Soviet Union did. The idea that Ukrainians, Latvians, Lithuanians, all the rest are going to look and think, oh, well, Russia's a nice place, they're never going to come us to do us in. They want to sign a military alliance,
we did have a coup in Kiev, didn't we, in 2014.
Indeed, we had the coup in 2014, but that's still no reason to go in and break somebody's bone. That was a Ukrainian coup. It didn't require Russian troops going in. The Russians certainly weren't welcome. I mean, this is a nonsense. The Ukrainian war is a just war under their terms. Putin was the person who started it. And you can't get away from this. And please, to have all this about the military-industrial complex. Yeah. Sorry. But really, we're... This idea that Russia is a benevolent state simply looking after itself is absolute codswallop.
Okay, well, you're perfectly entitled to your point of view. What can you just tell us, because we seem to be inching towards the very nuclear war that you were trying to avoid.
Absolutely.
And that's all the fault of the Russians, is it?
Well, certainly the Ukrainian war is the fault of the Russians. Yes, you can argue as much as you like about should NATO be expanding, but the use of force by the Russians against Ukraine is absolutely what is responsible for the present military conflict. And indeed,
can we just go back to the nuclear side?
Yeah, sure, the nuclear side. You're absolutely right. I mean, the Americans...
Did you ever predict this sort of thing happening when, back in the 1950s and 60s?
What, that there will be a war and nuclear weapons will be used?
Absolutely. We could tear up the nuclear treaties and we could be getting back to the point where they may be used.
Russia's pulled out of so many treaties on the nuclear front. Please don't start that game. This is an absolute nonsense. Of course, we've looked at the possibility of, and my own position is that using nukes is an absolute disaster for anybody,
Americans to bring nuclear weapons back to Britain now, for example, which is what they're saying they're going to do.
Europe is frightened of Russia on the move, and there's no reason for them not to be, because what Putin is after is actually to reconquest the old Russian Empire. He wants to expand it out. He wants to do it. He believes that's Russia's role in the world, as to control that part of the world. It's as dangerous as America trying to control Latin America by forcing it to do various things. It's as wrong as the Americans interfering in the Italian elections and getting...
So would you make an equivalence between the American empire building and the Russian empire building?
I would certainly say that colonial empires and Russia's way of building an empire is the same thing. Russia wants a colonial empire of Eastern Europe. American wanted a cold America... thing in the south, and we want our own empire, and that was colonial. This is all the expansion of national states.
Okay,
and
well,
with
that's
nuclear
that's,
weapons.
That's Martin
that's
Smith.
Dangerous.
Martin Smith, we just heard from Martin Summers. Sorry to confuse you, everybody. No. Martin Summers is on the line. Martin, what do you make of what you just heard from Martin Smith there?
Well, we're obviously not going to agree about this, so let's just recognise that. You mentioned the interference in Italy in the 1940s, but I was in Italy in the 1970s when NATO intelligence services blew up Bologna railway station. And of course, there's been a court case in Kyiv, if we can call it that, Kyiv, in 2017, where it became clear that the massacre in the Maidan Square was carried out by a NATO death squad, mostly from Georgia, and led by an American called Boyenga, Colonel Boyenga of the 101st Airborne. Now, you don't see anything about that in the mainstream media here, but I did discuss that on RT at the time. Putin has just won an overwhelming election victory in Russia, I'm afraid, because in actual fact, the people in the East Ukraine don't see themselves as Ukrainian at all. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, and NATO went to war so that Kosovo could take itself out of Serbia. They put the case that they were being oppressed by the Serbs, even though they'd been part of Serbia forever. And don't forget, the whole of Yugoslavia was created in 1919, and Ukraine has only existed since 1991. Crimea was only put into Ukraine in 1954 by Khrushchev, even though it's got an overwhelmingly Russian-speaking population. And in the western part of the Ukraine, there's large chunks of it which are actually used to be part of Hungary and Romania, and they've got large minorities there that don't want to be part of the Ukraine either. Now, NATO was quite happy to break up Yugoslavia. The Germans, for example, recognised the independence of Croatia, even though the British thought that was unwise, because it was part of NATO's policy of expansion. And, of course, we imposed Boris Yeltsin on the Russians in the 1990s. I used to go to Russia quite a lot in that era. And, of course, they imposed Thatcherism on them, which actually destroyed millions of lives, which was totally unnecessary, as Jeffrey Sachs, who was the main advisor to the Russian government at the time, is saying. And, of course, he's also saying that it's NATO that's responsible for the war in Ukraine. Now, I don't think you know that much about East European history. This is what worries me. Lots of people are totally ignorant. And not only are they totally ignorant, they don't know basic facts about what happened in 2014. That was a coup d'etat organised by the CIA, which involved killing pro-EU demonstrators. Over 80 of them were shot dead, and various Birkut riot policemen were also shot dead. But there's already been a court case in which it's proved that the Birkut riot policemen did not shoot those demonstrators. They were shot by a death squad brought in from Georgia, and we know this because two of the people from the death squad, they actually testified on Skype like this, or on Zoom, from Georgia, that they were involved in doing it. Now, that wasn't reported in the Western media. Now, my friend, did you know those facts, or did you not know them? I suspect you didn't know them because you weren't told, and you didn't.
Well, look, Martin, I'm asking the questions here, not you, Martin Summers. Oi, Summers, I'm asking the questions here, not you. I want to ask Martin Smith about the potential ways out of this, because certainly with both sides now threatening potential use of nuclear weapons, we're hearing a lot more in the press here about Russians, but we're also hearing about the United States moving weapons back into Europe, the sort of things that we were protesting about here with the cruise missiles in the 1980s, Martin. Do you think there is a way out of this? I mean, you know that within these big negotiations and to do with potential wars, you have to offer some sort of golden bridge to the other side to say you can climb down without losing face. Do you think that's possible with in Eastern Europe at the moment?
At the moment, no. I can't see what it is. I mean, maybe you could say that from a Ukrainian point of view, they would say, well, if we've got a bit of Russia, there's something there we can talk about. I can't see. I mean, you're right. Things are very dangerous. I mean, we are more in danger of a nuclear war now than at any time since the end of the Cold War. And it's not just in the Ukraine. It is in spilling over in the Middle East. The whole question of Iran and Israel and nuclear weapons there and going off. The world is in a damn sorry state. What can be done about it? Well, I think maybe both sides could stop being so insulting. I'm sorry to the other Martin that he thinks I know nothing about Eastern Europe. I made a 9-hour series called The Struggles for Poland, looking at what had happened as a microcosm of the 20th century. I've made a series producer 24 films on the Cold War. I do know a fair bit, and I certainly know that the Serbs are as guilty as mass murder as everybody else in that part of the world. The truth is, we are all capable of mass murder and horrible things, and we have to try and find and negotiate some way of getting out of it. And you don't make things better by sending tanks across a border that you have unilaterally recognized and you walk out. Yes, Russia, I see overwhelmingly. You may say she was prodded into it. Well, if she was prodded into it, then she was very 3 weeks because she sort of had more realization that such a route could be very dangerous. Now, as for the Russians having their wonderful free election, I'm sorry, it's quite a risible comment. Come on, Martin, you know full well the way in which those elections were organized. You know what happened to opposition candidates. You've got to move away from that. Got to be asking the question, how can we bring people together?
Well, I agree, but I mean, we have problems on our side too. We've got a democracy here, apparently, but we've now got a massive majority government on what was actually only 20% of the public actually voted for this government, but they've got a massive majority. A lot of people are just not bothering to vote, and even when they do, there's a very distorted picture ends up in the House of Commons. So we've got problems at our side too, but one of the things I'd like to just move the conversation onto now is to talk about economic problems in the West and other parts of the world and how they may be fueling some of the push for war, because we know that countries, when they're failing economically, like to try to get wars going to either get new territory or in order to give their population something to do, to join the army to fight, or else to open up new markets in arms and weapons and that sort of thing. So let's have a listen now to Michael Hudson, the economist, talking about the US debt and how the US debt is just getting more and more and more. China has basically won the economic war around the world, and the United States is failing.
America's never going to pay its debts. It doesn't have to. Its debts are in its own currency. We can simply print it. The African debt is not in its currency. The African debt is in U.S. dollars. Africa has to earn the U.S. dollars, and the only way it can earn the U.S. dollars is not to be assassinated for growing its own food and becoming independent and doing something that the United States does not like. The principle underlying the foundation of the World Bank is that no country should grow its own food. Africa and the Third World should only grow export crops. To export, in order to have an oversupply of cocoa and other tropical raw materials, to keep down the price, they must buy their grain from the United States or Europe, so that if they do something that we don't like, we can do what America tried to do to China in the 60s. We can sanction them. We can say, we're going to starve you. We're going to not export any grain to you. So owing their foreign debt in dollars means that they have to somehow sell something that the United States wants, not what they want. I think the most evil organizations in the world today are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
So that's economist Michael Hudson there. Now, look, Martin Smith, what do you make of this, the economic problems, particularly caused by the IMF? I mean, a lot of people have called it just another form of colonialism, and he's explaining there how these African countries particularly are bullied into growing things the Americans want rather than what they want.
I would say in terms of the conduct of America economically, it clearly has been disastrous for millions of people around the world, not least countries like Chile, who tried to change things and have a military coup imposed on them, financed by the United States in part, and absolutely terrible that the trade terms are unquestionably horrific, the way in which corporations are able to dictates to countries what food they are allowed to get or can afford to get. Absolutely, it is colonialism by another name. No doubt about that at all. And it's quite right to be challenged and gone for. And Oxfam and a whole variety of people know what the score is. It's quite disgraceful.
Yeah, I feel really sorry for Oxfam, actually. I mean, I got to know them a bit when I was living in Oxford, and they seem to be one of the best, in a way. You know, they had intellectual rigour to the campaigning that they were doing, and they've have been hit by all these rather dodgy scandals and things. And I look at that and I think, well, someone doesn't like what Oxfam is doing. But anyway, Martin Summers, what do you make of this idea that the Americans actually don't need to pay their own debt because it's all in dollars? They can just print it if they want. And that the whole thing is, in a way, a kind of ruse.
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of Michael Hudson, who's also an advisor both to the Russian and Chinese governments, as well as his own, as well as being a professor in the United States,
and an excellent writer too. Yeah, anyone on economics can read his stuff. I mean, it's great.
we're talking about imperialism here, and imperialism is, in fact, there's a massive literature about imperialism, and it isn't just about invading other countries. It's about controlling them and making them do what you want, which is exactly what was happening in Russia in the 1990s when Boris Yeltsin was, you know, he shelled the Russian parliament. Most people in the West have forgotten all about that, but they were, in order to force through the Gaidar plan, which was, you know, which was drawn up partly by Jeffrey Sachs, the parliament, Ruslan Kasbulatov, and the prime ministers and the various political forces in the parliament, the Duma, did not want to do what Yeltsin was wanted to do. So he shelled the parliament and killed hundreds of people. Most people in the West have forgotten all about that, but the Russians haven't forgotten about it. Their living standards have now massively improved. And one of the things that's happened in Russia is they've become completely self-sufficient in their own food supply and have become competitive with the US in supplying food to the rest of the world, even though the US is subsidized and the Russians are not. They were always going to be able to do that in the end once they got their act together. Just like their nationalized arms industry is far better than the, you know, jobs for the boys stuff we do. The Russians see themselves as leaders of the world movement against Western imperialism. And that's how they're seen in West Africa. And we were talking to people from Pakistan. They were waving Russian flags on their demonstrations against the military dictatorship in Pakistan, which has been imposed. You know, the Pakistani army is basically what used to be the British army. Now, I think there's lots of things we do agree about, Martin. We do. We do agree about lots of things. It's just that, we're at odds on what's going on in Eastern Europe. But I think, you know, it's good to talk about things, but we don't necessarily have to agree about everything.
No, we don't, Martin. No, we certainly don't. Another person who's been talking about economics recently, saying that it is also seems to be driving the elites and oligarchy in various parts of the world towards war, is a chap called Kim.com. We don't have him on this programme that often. He's a German, and I think maybe lived in Finland for a while, tech guru. He had some kind of website which was about file sharing, and he's been hit by various court cases and things over the years, but he's very outspoken, and he spoke this is a couple of weeks ago now, so he had this to say about Europe, it seems to have lost its head. He's saying economically Europe is self-immolating. It's almost trying to commit suicide.
The West, you know, the European nations, they are acting completely irrational. And Europeans are looking at this and are saying, why are you doing this? Why are you allowing the U.S. to bomb Nord Stream? Why are you allowing the U.S. to hurt the European economy? Why is the inflation allowed to be exported from the U.S. to Europe? And it's because this whole web of debt, international debt, is so intertwined in the West, where they are basically lending each other money, and their whole system is based on this US debt money printing system. So when the US collapses, and they are all aware of this, that this is about to happen, they are all going down with the U.S. because they all basically banked on the same debt system that the U.S. has created. And when that folds, they are all going down with the United States.
So that's Kim.com. He's a tech pioneer, not really quite one of your Peter Thiel or Eric Schmidt, Silicon Valley types, very much his own man. I think he lives in New Zealand now. But Martin Smith, give us an idea of what you make of possible causes, because, you know, I'm just postulating here is a lot of the drive for war is being caused by this economic failure.
And by climate change, by bad management, by debt, as you say, by debt that's unfair. There's no question about that in my mind, that the West has to look completely afresh at what its relations are economically with the rest of the world. I don't follow people saying the United States is going to collapse, it's all going to finish, and it's all going to be very different very soon.
It's very fair you say that, because hang on, we had Michael Hudson saying no, it won't collapse, and we had Kim.com saying yes, it will. So, you know, you're quite right to bring that up.
Right, well, yes, I mean, I I remember in my youth listening to a lot of people who adored Trotsky and convinced me that, or convinced others anyway, not me, that in fact, you know, this capitalist system was going to collapse very soon and it would all be all right. It hasn't happened that way. It's a very long, long economic war before we get anything fair and correct. And what one hears about the way in which Europeans and white Europeans carry on with their businesses. I mean, you know, you only have to look at where we are. We have corrupt banks. We have corrupt engineering companies. We have poisonous water companies. We're full of absolute horrors. We can't know how to manage ourselves. America is killing itself in many ways, industrially and economically, and the working class in America stay stuck. They can't climb out of it. It's very good. We need to look at ourselves, and the world is very nasty. And
is that human nature, do you think?
I regret to say that, yes, I think it is. I think I'm not a Christian, which upsets many of my friends in the band The Bomb Movement, but you see, I think if there is a divinity up there, why has he set up a system in which everybody's life depends on killing something else? The plants are eaten by the animals have to kill other animals, we have to compete ourselves. It's an absolute struggle.
We can't be vegetarians. Hitler was a vegetarian, wasn't he?
He was indeed. But he was quite willing to do in other people and allow the food. I mean, I think, yes, human beings are basically selfish and murderous. We follow the way all through. You look at all human histories, it's an empire here that goes down. You know,
that's what's called, take over. In Christianity, that's called original sin, isn't it? This sort of tendency just to be selfish. And you know, you have to work quite hard not to be.
Well, I'm sure I'm an original
sinner. Maybe you're drifting
sinner.
Towards the faith of your friends without even realizing it.
I really do believe that the human race depends on the human race to survive, and the human race has to try and sort it out. And you know, and things can sometimes be better. Look, in my lifetime, I've seen gays be allowed to be married. I've seen women had more rights than they've had before. I have had kids getting more rights. It's much better than it was. And if you think racism in this country is bad now, you should have tried racism 50 years ago. On all those fronts, we're moving forward, but we only move forward because people get together and they say, this is wrong, we've got to do something better.
So Martin Summers,
we've got to sort it out.
Martin Summers, can you just give us briefly your view on these sort of philosophical points here about human nature? Are we bound to just be fighting each other?
Well, I mean, the so-called realist view of international relations is that it's, you know, it's basically a balance of power between people, you know, states standing in for people, struggling to control their environment and so on. I'm agnostic about whether people are bad or good. They can be anything. It just depends on the circumstances and you know, what happens to people. I mean, I'm 64. And I grew up in the 1960s, and, you know, people expected and they got improvements in living standards every year. They got chances to go to study and become different people than they previously were. It was a very positive time, but it was not based on free market, full-on free market capitalism. It was a very managed setup after the Second World War in this country and in the United States until the 1980s. When there was this kind of counter-revolution by these people who wanted to bring back the 19th century. And they have, in fact, succeeded in bringing back the 19th century, where a small minority engrosses everything to themselves and puts everybody else out. And, of course, the system doesn't work very well when you do that. You do, in fact, need redistribution for the capitalist system to be functional. So getting rid of redistribution was obviously a disaster. And it was as much of a disaster, more of a disaster in Russia and the former Soviet Union. It was a disaster in Poland as well. I lived in Poland during the Balcerowicz plan. Absolutely appalling. Ordinary people just had their living standards smashed, totally unnecessarily. We could have approached these things in a much more realistic way than we did. And we're now where we are because of all that.
Okay, well, I'm sure you managed to squeeze something about human nature into there. Before we finish, I'd like to do a couple, look at a couple more things. One of which, we can't really speak to you, Martin, here, Martin Smith, without talking a bit about the recent problems that there have been with the far right in Britain, suddenly popping up their head, riots in Southport, even here in Bristol a couple of weekends ago. So let's have a listen now to someone I'm actually quite a big fan of. He's not with us anymore. He's the former General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, a guy called Bob Crowe, talking about this.
Now, we went down to Barking as a trade union, and we believed that Barking was the way that we should get involved in. Barking had nearly 13 BNP councillors, 12 councillors, and they lost one seat before the election. 13 British National Party councillors. In an area that used to be completely Labour-dominated. They never even bothered putting up candidates in some areas of Barking. It was in the middle of the biggest manufacturing factory in this country, Fords at Dagenham. And what happens is that when you lose your manufacturing base like Fords, and you lose your docks, and there's no industry, and your kids can't get municipal housing, they have to move 100 miles away, then the BNP can say, look what's happening. It's all the blacks that are taking your jobs. It's all the Eastern Europeans taking your houses. And the BNP could only survive when there's social deprivation. You know, you don't see when these people say about riots on the streets. Isn't it funny, it's always in working class areas that these riots on the street happen. You don't see them happen in Boris Johnson's area, do you, around, Harrow, or Cameron's area around Harrow. Or you don't see all these riots down at Eton, or these riots that take place down Henley-on-Thames, and they've got their regard to it. It's always where there's social deprivation takes place. And what we did, we organised the meeting, and it was why vote BNP. And we was going down there with Billy Bragg. We had the Barking Theatre organised, and the Barking Theatre pulled the plug because they said they were scared because we were having a political meeting in Barking. Of course we were having a political meeting in Barking, to expose the BNP. But there were some people, wrongly in my view, that said that the only way you can deal with the BNP is to go on the streets and beat them up. Well, two, in Barking Act was done. In Barking, with Hope Not Eight and a unified anti-BNP campaign, everyone managed about to put the point of view back over to the working people that these people only live on scapegoatism. They only live when there's mass unemployment, shortage of housing, and at the moment it's Eastern European people are the people that are targets. And before them, it was the Asians. Before the Asians, the West Indians. Before the West Indians, the Irish. And before the Irish, the Jews. Because what the capitalist system don't want, as Steve Wallace rightly said, was what they don't want is unity of working people to look at the real problems of the real world. That why can't we provide houses, jobs, national health, education, and decent pensions for our people concerned?
So I think some great points really being made. Sorry about the blips through there by former the General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, Bob Crowe. Anyway, after that, follow that if you can, Martin Smith. What do you make of the recent riots that have been around the country?
I'd like to take us back a bit to Martin talking to Martin talking about his dissatisfaction with the country and so on and what was happening. And I would say really that things have always been bad when nationalism takes over and when nationalism can breed on things that are really upsetting. I go back not to the time Martin's talking about, but even earlier, which Bob Crowe just walked out, we had race riots when there was just a handful of West Indians over here and when supposedly the world was economically beneficial and doing rail. I think there has been a seismic change in Britain. I went and worked in the States for 2 years, just at the start of the Falklands War. Maggie Thatcher was there. She'd taken over. When I came back 2 years later, I honestly didn't recognise the England I'd been brought up in. It had turned so selfish, so refusing to see that there are other people on need, that the whole mood changed.
So is this the 1980s you're talking about?
And it's moving on. We're talking, for example, I was very angry with Tony Blair attitude and Mandelson's attitude that the workers have nowhere else to go, so they'll vote Labour. The answer is they have somewhere else to go. They can move right. And that's exactly what's happened. And where we are now on race relations is in no small way due to the way in which people have been forgotten, not listened to at all.
Wow. Well, just before we say goodbye to you, Mark, it's been fascinating. I don't know if there is it possible for. Do you have a blog or is there anywhere on.
I don't have
you
a
have
blog.
Anything like
if
that?
If you want to find out more about my. If you want to find out more about my career, you can go to www.aboutmartinsmith.co.uk, which has more information than most people would need. But as to my actual philosophical approach to economics, wars and so on, I recorded 43 talks during lockdown, which was broadcast on community radio in Bristol, on BCFM, and that's been converted into a book. It's called Matters of Life and Death, Living with History in a Pandemic. And I look at how history has influenced our lives today, especially during the pandemic. It's less than a tenner, self-published by me, but you can get it easily off that wretched capitalist giant Amazon or a few Bristol bookshops. But I published it, but I was told it was too nuanced for a too interesting commercial publisher. So my nuances are there if you care to look for them. Matters of Life and Death, Living with History in a Pandemic, or www.aboutmartinsmith.co.uk. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, finally, I'd like to just look at the bomb itself. And I spoke recently to a chap called Roger Leavers. He's done a book on something called Farm Hall, which was a place where a lot of Nazi nuclear scientists were taken at the end of the Second World War. And there were secretly microphones were put in there to listen to them, to see what they were talking about. And, of course, when the news came through about the atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these Nazis got extremely talkative and revealed quite a lot. But anyway, here's a little excerpt from a longer interview I'll put up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk with Roger Leavers, who's done this book about Farm Hall.
This is the problem with Operation Epsilon and the German nuclear scientists, is it's always a matter of opinion. Looking at what the scientists were saying when they were locked up in the hall, and you look at the transcripts, they talk about the bomb, etc., or making a bomb, but they're mostly just relaxed and they're trying to talk about fission, nuclear fission. Some of them were old school Germans. In other words, these were from Teutonic families that went back hundreds of years. They, in my opinion, and looking at the Farm Hall transcripts, you can see that they weren't interested in a bomb. They didn't want a bomb. They didn't think it was actually a good idea to have a bomb. Who are you going to threaten with it? London, Paris, Amsterdam, and what's the point? You know, you're going to use it as a bargaining tool. You know, if you wipe out London, they're going to come and wipe us out. So there was a lot of arguments about that. There's also a good degree of evidence that the more senior scientists, the ones who were the most respected and the slightly older ones, almost deliberately got their calculations wrong. It would appear that they were giving information out when people were trying to get funding for their research to make a bomb. These scientists were saying, well, actually, his figures are wrong. You can't make a bomb unless you have this amount of uranium, or you've got this, or you've got that. And that turns out in the transcripts. You see this when Hiroshima, they are in one of the rooms in Godmanchester when they hear of Hiroshima. You can see then how this suddenly escalates from the fact that they're not really getting on particularly well with some of the more senior, well, more the, some would say, diehard Nazi scientists. It then becomes very aggressive, because these scientists are saying, well, how can they have made it? The Americans are fools. How can they make a bomb? They're 10 years behind us. But, of course, they then start to find out just how much resources were being thrown by the Americans at creating this bomb. And the Germans didn't have those resources. They may have had those at the start of the war, possibly. But as the war progressed and it twisted and turned back to come towards them, and, you know, D-Day happened and they started to lose ground in Russia and the North Africa, Hitler, I think, became far more interested in sudden terror weapons, V1s, V2s, rocket-powered fighter planes, all these sort of things that he thought could, you know, cause terror and bring the war maybe a little bit back to them. I don't believe in my own mind that the Germans, I think some of them wanted to build a bomb. I have no doubts in my mind, it's quite clear some wanted to build a bomb, but those diehard Nazis, it appears, were blocked by others trying to squeeze down their resources and their access to money, etc. And so I think there was a definite plan by some to block the whole operation, to make sure it didn't happen. There's also a number there who were actually trying to create a nuclear engine. So not a bomb at all, but they wanted to create an engine that would give a ship or maybe a plane or a tank endless energy, something they could harness to power vehicles and ships and planes rather than just a bomb, which they didn't see as being something the Germans should really have.
So that's Roger Leavers there. Book is just actually forthcoming, coming out soon about that. But I'll put the interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. So what do you make, Martin Smith still joining us. This whole idea of many of the people who were developing the bomb actually were from Eastern Europe and from Nazi Germany. In fact, the atom was split before World War II in Berlin. So, in a way, it's quite amazing that that the Americans got the bomb and not the Germans.
Well, of course, there were a lot of East Europeans who'd fled to America for more money and more riches, and they were there, so they were available. It isn't surprising that the Germans had the brains in which they have. You're talking about Germany, probably the most civilized, in quotes, nations in Europe, with culture, with engineering, with music, with absolutely everything. And this was a country that willingly absorbed everything that Hitler offered them and was so pleased to be part of the Third Reich and referred to the time of the Third Reich as the time of paradise. So how civilized were they? They got the brains, but then...
No, but they couldn't... But, you know, so anyway, your just remind us of your website again, please.
www.aboutmartinsmith.co.uk.
Okay, Martin Smith, thanks ever so much for joining us. Fascinating. At Martin Summers, what do you make about of this business of who managed to get to first to make the bomb?
Well, that's one for the historians, isn't it? It's not you can have matters of opinion about this, but it's just a matter of fact. And of course, a lot of it was very secretive, so it's very hard to know who knew what. One of the problems that the Germans had was because they were so down on the Jews, lots of Jewish scientists, not least Albert Einstein, fled from their clutches. And, you know, these people were not available to help them develop their bomb because they didn't want them and they didn't get them. And, of course, Einstein himself said, if I'd known after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, he said, if I'd known, I would have been a locksmith. Because, of course, he approached Roosevelt and said, look, there's a possibility that they could make a bomb with my theories, and you need to take it seriously. And, of course, he was always opposed to nuclear weapons. Einstein, one of the great human beings.
Yeah, so the Americans, when they used the bomb, they said, thank God this has fallen to us. I think many people will be now wondering, the people that have inherited this bomb, whether they're Russian or American or Chinese, someone at some point is likely to use it, aren't they?
If you're asking me, the answer is probably yes, of course.
Isn't it inevitable? And maybe it always was inevitable.
Well, maybe it was, but back in the day when the other Martin was talking, in the 50s, the 60s, and the 80s, when I was young, people were very well aware that there was a real danger that this could turn into a disaster. I'm afraid what's happened since then is people have got used to driving drunk, and they've not crashed yet, so therefore it's okay to drive drunk, but it's not really, and someday we will crash unless we get our act together to stop it. And of course, putting all these missiles into Eastern Europe, all of these treaties, it's not the Russians who've withdrawn from these treaties. It's not the Russians at all. They wanted to keep all of those treaties. It's Trump and the West that ripped up all
their
treaties.
In fact, wasn't it? It was Christmas. It was Christmas 2021. The Russians twice desperately said, "Look, we need a new peace treaty. Please, will you negotiate?" They said it to the European Union in Brussels. They also said it to the United States, and nobody wanted to know. Maybe that's because NATO told them they're not allowed to. Anyway, one of our senior diplomats, at least he's an ex-senior diplomat who's been involved with negotiating with the Russians over the years, and also as part of NATO, is Lord Peter Ricketts, and he had this to say about the Kursk incursion this week.
A little earlier, I was talking to Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, who chaired the Joint Intelligence Committee, or JIC, under the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and he was also the UK government's first national security advisor from 2010 to 2012 under Prime Minister David Cameron. On top of that, he served as a permanent representative to NATO. I asked him how he viewed the Ukrainian incursion into Russia.
I'm watching it with a sense of understanding for what Zelensky's trying to do. His phrase was bringing the war home to Russia. And I think the point is that Russia has felt that it's able to occupy, bombard the whole of Ukraine with complete impunity for 2 years. And I think the Ukrainian government thought it was time to turn the tables on them and show that they are vulnerable in their rear areas, that their forces are not operating well there, gives Putin a real problem at home, explaining what's going on, and it boosts Ukraine's morale. I think the point is to make Putin realize that it's not all going his way, as I say, to give him a problem with public opinion. I don't think the Ukrainians are going to stay there very long, frankly. I don't see them trying to defend a front line that's inside Russia. I would think it's more like a kind of raid, a big raid that they then pull back from, but with the implication that they could do it again elsewhere sometime.
Should there be any red lines as far as the UK or Western allies are concerned?
Well, I think the red line in terms of particularly of use of UK-supplied weapons must be respect for international humanitarian law. In practice, therefore, I think using the weapons against military targets or targets related to Russia's military offensive in Ukraine, like the defense industry or infrastructure, but being very careful not to strike Russian civilians in a way that Russia, of course, is taking no such precaution when they attack Ukraine.
Yes, and that's Lord Peter Ricketts, Martin.
Well, it's the usual propaganda line that we're getting from the West. That's all that
well,
is.
No, hang on. What about this idea that maybe they will just stay there for a little while, come back and do it again somewhere else?
They're not going to be able to retreat from there, Tony. As me and Warren were pointing out earlier, they're now stuck. They can't retreat. The Russians won't let them retreat. They're going to kill them all or they're going to surrender. They're already in a cauldron, Kesselschlacht. So it's a last throw of the dice by the West. And, of course, they're talking now that they're going to force the Russians to negotiate. The Russians have had enough of negotiating. Well, Zelensky, of course, is not no longer
That's interesting
elected.
In itself, isn't it?
They're not negotiating with Zelensky because he was supposed to stand for election in May. Putin stood earlier in the year and won. Zelensky was supposed to stand for election in May. He didn't.
So there is obviously no real president.
He's got no mandate, and the Russians aren't going to. In any case, the Russians don't think.
Martin, I just want to ask you, what do you think about this whole idea that this is a last gasp? You may be right. This sort of implies that something, maybe some nasty surprise prepared in another part of the world, like the Middle East.
Well, they're losing. Don't forget, the Israelis thought that they could cross Hamas in Gaza. But they haven't. The tens of thousands of Hamas fighters who are doing the fighting are still intact and are still fighting. The Ukrainians thought that they could win the war with the big offensive in 2023 with all of the stuff that the West supplied, including, of course, Storm Shadow missiles, which, as you saw, Starmer went to the NATO summit in Washington, and he said that we can use the Storm Shadow missiles to strike inside Russia. And then the Ministry of Defense had to put a out a statement saying, no, we haven't agreed that. Because what the Russians are going to say is, if you fire one of your missiles, say at a military base inside Russia, we're going to fire one back at a military base inside Britain, and you know we can do that. We've got the missiles. You fire at a military base in Russia and kill 15 of our people, we're going to fire back at Portsmouth and kill 25 of yours. What are you going to do about it? And the answer is nothing. Now, most people, we should have been discussing this at the election, but of course we weren't, because everybody's on the same page at the election. As our friend earlier, Putin's a dictator, even though he's just won an overwhelming election victory. And of course, when he talks about the opposition are all in prison, or what about Martin Luther King? What about Robert F. Kennedy? What about JFK? It's, the West assassinates and murders people. They killed the president of Chile. They do this all the time. And the idea that the West always tells the truth is simply wrong. And of course, the rest of the world can see through this. It's okay to convince the swing voter in Basildon of all of these things, but you're not going to convince the swing voter in Siberia or in South Africa or in Brazil or Venezuela. Yeah, the real world is a lot bigger than the Western media bubble. And of course, they don't understand how the rest of the world sees us.
No, they certainly don't seem to. Anyway, we're going to be talking about the horrific attack, the latest horrific attack on the school. 100 or so Palestinians murdered by the Israelis at the weekend. Absolutely terrible situation. And we also have our report from Wafa al-Udaini. But before the break, I'd just like to have a little look at King Charles. It's the most incredible situation, really, with 40-something million pound pay increases given himself from the Crown Estate. But I'd like to start because what they say is that the King has got no say over the Crown Estate. What Kevin Cahill was always telling me is that yes, he does, and this is what I recorded earlier this week, talking to Kevin about what exactly this Crown Estate is and whether it's really controlled by King Charles or not.
My name is Kevin Cahill, and I live in Exeter, in Devon. I'm a journalist and an author, and I worked at the Sunday Times and in Parliament, and I still work as a journalist.
Okay, can you tell us about your work with the landholding?
Signed me to look at old money in the UK, which essentially was land. So I did all the land stuff and eventually wrote the first book on land ownership that actually names the landowners. This was the difference between my book and anything else that's been written. I named all the landowners and I named the size of their estates from the second doomsday, which had been lost. Extraordinary how a country can lose a whole doomsday, but it had. So I then wrote another book called Who Owns the World? And finally, I wrote a book called Who Owns Ireland 2 years ago.
One of the most interesting things about this is the Crown Estate, isn't it? And the King Charles last year and this year has awarded himself enormous pay rises.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete anomaly. The King, King Charles III, remains, because nobody's changed anything, the largest landowner, legal landowner on earth. He owns, through the constitutions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and all sorts of places in the Caribbean. He is the ultimate landowner. And nothing has been done to change that. Now, in the UK, again, because freeholds are not ownership, most people don't know that. Freehold in the United Kingdom is a leasehold from the Crown, ultimately. So the person, you think you own your house and you say, I have the freehold, you don't own it. The Crown owns your house.
Yeah, but that's so nominal, surely. I mean, the idea that anyone who owns land in Australia, New Zealand, etc., the King's not going to come and claim that, is he?
No, the claims are, they're not unenforceable. In Canada in particular, which is very odd, the Crown ownership is ruthlessly enforced by the Canadian government, which is weird. In Australia, it's more shaky. The Australians are not formally querying this setup, but there are a lot of questions being raised in Australia about, you know, how the indigenous land was taken from the indigenous people and how it's all wound up in the hands of the British Crown, you know, 12,000 miles away.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about the Crown Estate? Where does it sit between private and public?
The Crown Estate, again, is a complete anomaly. It acts as a private estate but pretends it's a public corporation. It doesn't pay the normal taxes. The other thing is it distorts the position of the Crown, because the Crown Estate, in effect, means the largest landowner in the United Kingdom is the King, and that's completely unbalanced. You know, the rules are not applied to him, they're not applied to the estate, and huge amount of income from the public goes to the Crown.
And yeah, well, King Charles will say it's not actually his land, that this is some sort of arm's length business that he doesn't control.
It's not an arm's length business in the slightest. The papers I fished out in relation to the Crown Estate in London, I mean, they were actually the Crown Estate was deciding the colour of the front doors on part of its estate, and deciding which bits of London to buy and which bits of London to sell. In the early stages of the coalition government in 2010, the Tories transferred the ownership of the Crown Estate quite formally to the Crown. So now there's no confusion. The Crown owns the Crown Estate and directs the Crown Estate. And it's a very hands-on direction.
And over the last couple of years since the Queen has died, Charles has been awarding himself pay rises each year of around about £30-40 million.
Yep.
Can you just tell us what's been going on there?
This is money that's obtained, if you like, because he owns the Crown Estate. It's not taxed in the ordinary way. And the transfer of the Crown Estate from the late Queen to Charles was not taxed in any way. It was just a transfer that can't occur for anybody else. You know, if you or I die and leave an estate, we have to pay death duties. No death duties were paid on the richest and largest lump of land in the United Kingdom. But the Tories were complicit with the fiddle, and it was a fiddle. It remains to be seen if Labour are willing to tackle. It's going to be a two-stage thing. The position of the monarch is going to have to be regularised in a more normal way, like he has to declare his assets, etc., etc. And then the way the money from the Crown Estate is paid over to the monarch has to be regulated. You know, if you register your property in a offshore company and you trade, you know, you sell the company to somebody else, you don't pay any tax. It's a tax-free fiddle. And it was a special fiddle, specially arranged by the last government we had. So, you know, it's going to be a monumental task to straighten this business of what the monarch is and what the monarch owns and how it's to be regulated.
Yeah, it's not just that, is it? I mean, people from the Crown Estate obviously are appointed by the monarch. Even government ministers officially are actually appointed by the King.
Yeah.
The new government needs to start. Reform the monarchy, reform the land registry, and give ownership of the freeholds to the public. There's nothing in the, what do you call it, the agenda, the Labour Party programme, to even touch these subjects.
No, in fact, the only thing apparently is going to be maybe some reform of the House of Lords. Martin, Kevin is... I want to say something about the interview I did with Kevin yesterday on Zoom, which normally works fine. And as soon as we got to the bit about the appointments of... what power the King has to appoint people in this country, that is to say, judges, army officers, police chiefs, government ministers, and various others, then everything sort of went wrong. And Kevin, as in the middle of speaking, suddenly his mic was automatically muted, and it was impossible to hear him from then on. So apologies for the problems with the sound quality there. I did eventually manage to get the whole interview, which I'll put up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk, with a few little bits missing. just only short bits, but certainly got the sense of what Kevin was trying to say. So I'm suggesting that also, Martin, of course, the chiefs of GCHQ and the intelligence services are also appointed by the king. And he, in fact, he's the patron of all these organisations too nowadays. So he takes a great deal of interest. In fact, the one of the other organisations that he's involved in appointing people to is the BBC. Now, we're supposed to believe that actually it's the government that appoints these people, but we've got a very pliable government now who will just give a list of people to the king, or take a list of people from the king, and then they will decide amongst one of the people that the king wants to be in charge. And I know, you know, I don't know what you make of the Martin, of the situation with the Crown Estate, but certainly the king seems to be, to me, a fascist who's actually wielding an immense amount of power these days. It's something that his mother was much more sort of laid back about these things and would let the government take the lead. He now seems to be implementing much of his people into these positions. So, for example, bringing back Ed Miliband. This is something the Labour Party's done, but it's something that the King thoroughly approves of because they're best buddies. So, anyway, what do you make of the Crown Estate initially?
Well, I mean, the Crown Estate is an absolute anomaly, as pointed out by Kevin. Clearly, they should be something done about that. If you think about it, if they paid the death duties on the Crown Estate, that would have given the Labour government loads and loads of money to spend on, I don't know, social housing, invading Ukraine.
Public sector pay, for example.
Yeah, public sector pay. So, you know, this is not trivial, is it? When they get away with that. And of course, if we are going to pay the Crown to do the job it does for the rest of us, then why should they have the Crown Estate as separate from the rest of the... I mean, ultimately, I would want to abolish the monarchy, and the Crown Estate should simply be taken into the public sector, and he can go off and find a job somewhere, probably being an old farmer. Yeah? What about that for the future? But of course, that's not going to happen, and we all know why. Because that's not the way the world is. Keir Starmer is not going to do that. Even Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't dare to do that. And that's the real world we live in, where they...
Even though the King says he's not in charge of the Crown Estate, Kevin's explaining, yes, he is. He's lying. He is in charge. And from the revenue from the Crown Estate, King Charles has, in the last couple of weeks, given himself a £45 million pay rise. Just in one year.
Don't forget, he also gets paid by the rest of us from our PAYE, which gets taken out every week or month from our pay packets, so that he can be the king, you know, and do all the stuff that the king does, travelling around and all the rest of it. Now, in the Middle Ages, they used to have the line that the king must live of his own, yeah? There's no reason why we should give you any money. You're the richest guy in the country, you know, John the First or whatever, and there's no reason why we should give you anything, because you're already the richest guy in the country. You should manage with that, surely. And this, of course, is one of the reasons that led to Charles the First proroguing Parliament and all the rest
of it. Yeah, that's right. Well, just to give you an idea of the figures involved, last year the King got £86.3 million. This year, because of his £45 million tax, £45 million pay increase he's awarded himself, he's now getting £132 million from the UK Treasury.
Well, that's right. And of course, he can't spend all of that on going to nightclubs or whatever, and that's just money that he uses to reinvest to keep his family in the position that they're used to, and of course to push his own little agenda, whatever it might be.
I mean, one of the reasons the Crown Estate is made...
Russia, for example, he's very much in favour of you know, Putin's the most evil man ever, and all the rest of it.
Well, yeah, and also very anti-Hamas too, who he considers a terrorist organisation, as he announced in last year's King's speech. This is another aspect to this, is he's taking an increasing role politically, isn't he? He called Putin Hitler, and he's also having a go at Hamas in the King's speech last year, Martin. So he's taken a very strong position.
Not written by him. He probably does think Hamas are, like, you know, terrible, but the speech is actually written by the government of the day. That was written by Rishi Sunak or by Keir Starmer. They're all. I mean, Hamas and Hezbollah were only made illegal organisations in the early 1920s.
Twenties?
The 2020s. Yeah. So it's actually quite recent. Before that, they were just regarded as foreign political organisations. So the idea that they are terrorists is a relatively recent innovation.
So one of the big things in the Crown Estate, which I didn't go into with Kevin, but I mean, it's quite clear on the article, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is the massive increase in the success of offshore wind farms, because he owns the entire seabed. And every time there's one of these offshore wind farms, which is part of the government's programme, are you sure that Starmer and the Labour government wrote the King's speech, Martin? There's a big thing in there by the King about how they're going to increase all these offshore wind farms, which specifically and personally benefits King Charles. And also, of course, the massive amounts of agricultural subsidies that go to these farms of the Crown Estates that then get sent straight back to King Charles's coffers in terms of rent.
Well, that's right. And, of course, he also owned the rights to the North Sea oil. It was only became clear relatively recently that he did own the continental shelf around the country. I just presumed it belonged to us, but apparently it belongs to him. So he must have been taking rents from North Sea oil when that was all going on. Well, I mean, the agricultural subsidies. I mean, do we need agricultural subsidies now we're outside the EU, Tony? I mean, farmers should just make their own living. Maybe he should just have to make his own living, you know, get behind the tractor and see if you can make a living, King Charles. No, you're not King Charles anymore, just Charles Windsor. We've taken the Crown Estate off you. You don't have to do any work for us anymore because we've got we don't bother having a king anymore, and you can go and be a farmer. But you'll find it's very hard work without subsidies, as many farmers are finding out.
Well, there is this rather wonderful group called Republic, which is very critical of the Crown, particularly of Charles personally. And what we find, Martin, is that the MI5 and the anti-terror police do these kind of swoop raids. As soon as there's any event which Republic might turn up at and wave some banners in front of the TV cameras, then they're basically arrested before they've even done anything.
Well, that just goes to show, Tony, the repression of the political opposition here in Britain, which means all of our elections are invalid because of the repression of the political opposition. There's loads of people who got positions against Starmer and against the King, but they get persecuted and pushed into prison and messed around with. It's far worse than Russia, isn't it? Where in actual fact, you've got lots of different political parties. The Communist Party being the main opposition party in Russia, who are pushing Putin to take a harder line. Mironov, who's the head of Fair Russia, this week was saying if they're going to start bombing the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, we need to assassinate the people making those decisions. And Putin is saying nothing. But that's what the pressure Putin is coming under from the opposition in Russia, is that we need to take a harder line with people like King Charles, Starmer, Biden. These people, we need to start topping them. Now, that's not what Putin's saying nothing, but talking about whether we have free elections or not. How free are our elections? And the answer is not very free at all.
You're absolutely right. Particularly
the
with the suppression.
If Putin had got 50% in the first round, it would have gone to a second round.
Particularly with the suppression of Galloway's Workers' Party in the last election was absolutely horrendous.
Well, that means we don't have to accept the election results at all, do we?
Yeah, I mean, for example, not even listing them. You know, when newspapers are printing lists of candidates, Galloway's party's not even mentioned by the newspaper, even though they're standing candidates. They stood 150 candidates, and many of them were just got no press coverage whatsoever. So that's a way of making sure.
In other words, according to the argument made earlier, there's no legitimacy to British elections at all, and foreign states don't have to recognise our government as legitimate. And, of course, they can call for the assassination of the leaders of our state, as Western politicians frequently do, of the leaders of the Russian state. You can see the Russian middle class ain't very happy with this attitude towards them. And they're quite powerful these days. They've got one, a big middle class. They never used to have one. They've got one now. And they know everything we do. They all speak English. They watch all of our TV shows and radio shows. They travel. They know what goes on. But people in the West, they don't know what goes on in Russia. Most of them have never been there and have got no idea what modern Russia's like at all.
Election fixing, people are worried over in the United States, Martin, about this. I noticed on the PBS channel, since you're talking about whether elections are free and fair or not, voting experts in the States are warning of serious threats for the 2024 election, presidential election, from election equipment software breaches. An effort to access voting system software in several states and provide it to allies of one political party or another as they sought to overturn the results of the 2020 election has raised serious threats ahead of the presidential contest, according to a group of experts who urged federal agencies to investigate. Well, I'm not sure if that's much point in the federal agencies investigating it, because they're part of the people who are fixing these elections. The letter sent by nearly two dozen computer scientists, election security experts and voter advocacy organisations asks for a federal probe and a risk assessment of voting machines used throughout the country, saying the software breaches have urgent implications for the 2024 election and beyond. The breaches affected voting equipment made by two companies together count over 70% of the votes cast across the US, according to the letter. I'll put a link up again to that one on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It sounds to me, Martin, like they're saying basically these US elections that are coming up, they could fairly easily be hacked.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time if that happened. Elections in the US are organised on a local level, and local bosses often fix things. Like Texas voted for JFK and Lyndon Johnson because Lyndon Johnson was the big boss in Texas, and he made sure that Texas went Democratic, which is why he was put on the JFK as his vice president. So fixing elections is as American as apple pie. I'm slightly changing the subject, but not. There's all this stuff about how the Venezuelan election was supposedly rigged by Maduro, although in actual fact, their election system is far superior to anything that we do in this country or in the United States. And he won 51% of the vote, and he is the elected president. And of course, the Western powers immediately started saying it's a fix, it's a fix, it's a fix. But I don't think it is a fix. And you can't take anything they say at face value. They lie and they lie and they lie. And they lie, and they lie. They said that Nicaragua's elected government wasn't elected because it's led by Daniel Ortega and the FSLN. But they did win, and the Western powers encouraged people to go out into the street and say, no, 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 they didn't win, they didn't win, they didn't win. But it's just for Western consumption.
Just for on this hacking business, I don't know if you know, but there's this thing called a flipper zero. I don't know if you've heard about these things, Dave. What they do is they listen to, as someone is locking and unlocking their car, they're listening to it. They're also going to the car. They're interrogating the car's chips. And this thing called a flipper zero, apparently you can actually just unlock a car with a flipper zero. They're not banned in this country. You can just buy them. I think they're about £250. I won't say where you can buy them, but this is amazing, isn't it? It's almost like no one cares. Here's something that you can buy online. You can use it to break into a car, no one seems to care. None of the MPs have really picked up on this. None of the lawmakers are doing anything about it. And there it is, freely available online.
Well, I think elections aren't just rigged by electronic voting.
Looking at the wider thing about hacking. This is a little hacking device.
Happening in Venezuela, to come back to what I was saying a minute ago, is they're saying that their electorals, they've got a double system. There's a paper ballot and an electronic record of the paper ballot. But what happened is somebody hacked the electronic system and made it difficult for the government to come out and say what the results were, because it's been hacked. At the same time, as in with one voice, the whole of Western media, including The Guardian, going, but Maduro lost, he lost the election, he lost the election, he did lose the election. And you feel like saying, but he won all the other ones, why has he lost this one? It's the same with Lukashenko in Belarus. He's won six elections in a row. Now, that's not because it's a fix. It's because he's genuinely popular. And there's a reason why he's popular. The reason why Lukashenko's popular is he kept everybody in work when the Soviet Union was collapsing. It's largely a rural country. They kept the collective farms going and kept everybody in work. That makes him popular, especially when they look around and see what a mess happened in the nearby. I mean, with all the young people from the Baltic states have had to leave because there's no work in the Baltic states. That's why they're all over here. And of course, the other thing in Venezuela is they've provided millions of people with decent housing. That tends to make people loyal to the government.
Yeah, it's funny, but Colonel Gaddafi did that in Libya, didn't he? Anyway, what I'm trying to come to is the complete failure of the electoral system. Yes, okay, so maybe you're going to get somebody, if you're lucky, that you like. The whole system in this country keeps the smaller parties out, as well as if they're colluding with the media. and giving them no exposure at all, like they did with George Galloway's Workers' Party in the run-up to the recent general election here. You don't actually have a democracy, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, the person that will stay in power, of course, is King Charles. No one's going to elect him. So let's have a listen now to the much maligned, in fact, rather spied on and bullied and over-policed organisation called Republic. So let's have a listen now to one of the chaps. His name is Graham Smith from there talking recently.
We can't fund increase in or increase funding for the NHS when we're being told we can't deal with the cap on child benefits. We are giving over 2 years about £1 billion to the monarchy so that they can have palatial homes, helicopter flights here, there and everywhere for private as well as public travel, and huge pointless parades in London that only 9% were excited by last year.
Okay, I'll leave some of those more inflammatory things you wanted me to tease you about or ask you about just aside, but you mentioned the word helicopter. I read within this data dump from overnight, two new helicopters are going to be procured for official use. They argue it's going to be more efficient to do that, presumably, than to use many leases or private things. Is that something you can see there's a common sense approach there?
Well, the problem with the helicopter issue is that they use helicopters to travel everywhere as a routine when they could quite easily travel by car or by train. And, you know, we had a really farcical situation a couple of years ago where Charles, when he was still Prince of Wales, flew by helicopter from Gloucestershire, where he has the Highgrove home, to Cambridge, where he was met by his car. So his car went anyway. Driven to a university building where he lectured climate scientists on the need to reduce emissions from aircraft before going back in his car to the helicopter and flying back to Highgrove. And he does this routinely, and they all do it routinely. And they simply do not need to use helicopters in the way that most people might use a car. They can travel in normal transportation.
There are speed questions, there are safety questions, surely, that you have to add to those considerations.
Why? I mean, you know, Rishi Sunak was being routinely criticised for flying everywhere by helicopter.
But he had an argument, didn't he? As Prime Minister, he was trying to cram in 10 appointments each day.
Indeed. That's the Prime Minister. He has a real job. Charles doesn't cram in 10 appointments each day. If you look at his calendar, well before he was unwell, it was, you know, one appointment, maybe two appointments in a day in the same place usually, and then days and days without doing anything. He's not busy. He doesn't need to get around that quickly. There's no reason why
he can't. Cancer, we're told.
Well, as I said before, you know, looked at these. You do the number crunching going back years. They simply don't have that much to do. And the idea that he is in any way as busy as a prime minister, who, yes, arguably may need to get around quickly, he doesn't need to do that. And yet he flies around by helicopter simply to go from Buckingham Palace to Windsor, which is a relatively short journey. So they fly by helicopter all the time whilst lecturing people on climate change, and this is why he's a really poor advocate on the issue, because he is a grade A hypocrite.
Graham Smith, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Graham Smith is from Republic, the anti-monarchy campaign group.
Yeah, who also doesn't seem they're allowed to do any demonstrations, Martin, rather like the climate camp we were talking about at Drax last week, arrested before they even unfurl their banners.
We all know, presumably many people who listen to this show know, that the world ain't what mainstream media says it is. But I don't think, from my point of view, we should get too obsessed with the monarchy, because they're not the real power. The real power isn't them, it's other people.
Well, I think the real power is them, as we've just been talking about. They appoint the police chiefs, they appoint the army officers, they appoint the government ministers, they appoint the judges. And I say they, I'm talking about him. King Charles, and as I don't know if you remember from last year, where there was that ridiculous situation at the Cenotaph, where King Charles marches into the Foreign Office after the ceremony's finished, followed by David Cameron and Rishi Sunak, and the next morning it's announced that David Cameron is going to be our Foreign Secretary. Seems to me that this guy is absolutely decided he's going to be in charge and he wants to run things. So Anyway, David Halpin, I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and he had some interesting things to say about. He doesn't believe that King Charles has cancer.
There are certain obvious red lines, like, for example, a death certificate must be signed by a doctor.
Yes, well, that's different. That's changed since the our legislature, the House of Commons, has passed. It meant to be with the sunlight clause. It's meant to be an end to it. It's meant to be discussed again after 2 or 3 years. But I understand that the certification for cremation and death certification has changed. And a dear friend, whose partner died yesterday. Just over a day and a half ago, actually, the death certificate has been dealt with by a nurse from the hospice dealing with people who come to the end of their life. And the cremation certificate, I understand, can be partly signed by the funeral director. I think that's what she said. I can't believe it. It used to be two doctors. And as a young doctor, I had to sign, I don't know if it was part one or part two, I can't remember. But we had to see the corpse. And I was taught by a very good forensic pathologist I now know, a fellow called Mant, Keith Mant, who had been lecturing us about six times on forensic medicine at St. Mary's to my year group, qualifying in 64, 1964. And Mant said that you must see the whole of the body. So when we went to the mortuary, the technician would wheel out, you know, they'd draw out the metal bier, so to speak, and then they would take the gown off the corpse so we could examine it. It might even turn it over. And the reason why Mant showed it, he showed a slide of someone who'd had the cremation certificate signed and passed, and when you took the gown off, there was ligature around the neck. It was concealed by the gown. So
if you want to turn the body over, is that a job for the mortician or for the doctor?
Mortician. The mortician will do that. You say, can I look at the back? Do you see? You see, things like this, you see, and it applies to the Kelly case as well. I can go into the detail of that. But I remember learning in Bristol when I was a senior house officer in a surgical rotation, a rather good job, because we could stay in one place for 2 years with our two children, that in South Africa, one of the ways of killing people, silently, and of course, in the axilla, which is where it was done, in the armpit, you would be hard pushed to find this tiny puncture wound.
Well, if you lifted up your arm, you might even find somebody's number if they'd been in the SS. It would be tattooed on there.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Well, if you ever saw any of those, David. Yeah. But, I mean, we're talking here, really, aren't we, about a breakdown in law and order, I suppose.
Exactly.
So this is what happens if a nurse comes in and she's told, we'll just put this on the death certificate. And we spoke, didn't we, last year about the death of the Queen. In fact, I think it was 22.
Yes.
And about the suspicious circumstances around that death certificate, where the doctor had said on there, even though you're not allowed to put this, they'd said she died of old age.
I know, and it's happened recently. Here, in this parish, 300 yards from where I was sitting, a lady died. I won't mention her name now. She was quite elderly, but she was very sharp in her mind, a bit awkward of a personality, but she had a cancer. She'd been jabbed, she'd had the boosters as well, and I'm pretty sure she had a bone marrow cancer, the plasma cell tumour, in her spine. She called me in desperation because she wasn't getting any help from the practice. She was seen initially by a doctor, seen and examined. He said it's muscular. Her pain continued in her spine when she moved sharply, and she then had three telephone conversations about analgesia. You find this is happening. People are being advised to change, perhaps to up the dose or to have a more powerful analgesic painkiller. And this is what was happening. So she called me after 3 weeks because she was in severe pain.
So this is about dealing with the symptom rather than the cause.
It's dealing in a mechanistic, remote way, arm's length way. It is not what doctors are about. Doctors should see a patient face to face, and when they examine a patient and put their hands on a patient, that actually helps the healing process. Patients feel lightened by having a doctor touch them. That helps. And they also help by having a doctor concentrate his whole attention on the patient. Sometimes in my clinics in the health service, people say to me, it's very easy talking to you, Mr. Halpin. So that's music to my ears. because I was listening to them. And in listening, you can make the diagnosis, like I said, in two-thirds of cases, without any blood tests or scans or the rest of it. Now, this lady, what was her death certificate? How was it signed? Remotely, I think. You know what it said? Frailty due to old age. If I put that down on death certificate, if I put down old age, when I did it once, actually, as a young doctor, probably in the hospital, probably as a house physician or house surgeon.
And that's really, you're saying, I don't know why this person's died.
They were very old and frail, which is what they said about the Queen, really, effectively. Mm. But the thing is that would not have been tolerated. The registrar of deaths would have phoned me up and said, Mr. Hurt, it happened to me. You cannot put that down. You have to have a diagnosis like bronchopneumonia. Now, my friend, house partner, friend of mine too, he died yesterday, probably with bronchopneumonia. But he had congestive cardiac failure, that would have been as well on the certificate, and probably also, it may have been that he added a tumour. He was wasting to a degree. But we're dealing with a mechanistic, careless approach, and I say that to care is the most important characteristic of any worthwhile society, and to generalize, people care less. And I wanted to speak today briefly, Tony, about the fact that we have become inured to the fact that no one is accountable, no one is ever brought to the bar. I've been reading John Pilger's book. He wrote so much, as you know, and made about 70 films. He died about 6 months ago now. And sadly, he was sucked into the COVID thing as well. Did you know that? He was promoting it.
Okay, but before we talk about Pilger, let's just go back to the Queen for a moment, because it was very disingenuous, and in fact it's a lie to say that she died of old age. She was being treated for something, quite clearly. She had marks on her arm that showed that she'd been being treated in some way.
She had had blood tests taken, hadn't she? She'd had blood taken. She had, I think, we discussed this. She had bruising or something similar above her right wrist. And we imagine that she had some blood tests taken. She was being attended by a GP who they favoured in the Balmoral area. I forget his name now. But he signed the death certificate. But that certificate, which I think used the term old age, would not have been tolerated when I was a young doctor.
Well, it's another aspect to all of that. I mean, because I think there's something has to be said about all this, is the way that the previous king, George the Fifth, I think it was, who was succeeded by Edward the Eighth, the Nazi king, his doctor, it was published, I think it was in the 1990s, in his doctor's memoirs, he made it quite clear, well, Edward had encouraged me to dispatch him because he was a sort of in-the-way kind of character. He wasn't well.
You told me that.
He wasn't well. But this thing is known in the royal family that if there's an elderly royal that's in charge and the new kid on the block, in this case Prince Charles, now King Charles, comes along, it's not unheard of for them to just say, well, can you just get her out of the way?
Well, but I thought his appointment was very long delayed, wasn't it?
And now he has cancer. We have also spoken about the possible doubts over that. Yes. But he's now off to Samoa with cancer, and along with Camilla too. So I look at that whole business and think, well, look, you don't really like doing these public duties. The cancer is quite a handy cop-out.
He doesn't look to me like a chap with cancer. His daughter-in-law does.
Just by looking at somebody?
Well, yeah, I know. This is a broad brush. But he doesn't look to me like a man who's got a cancer.
Do people slow down, or what sort of signs?
Well, no, there's a colour about them. Do you know, I remember a German nurse who worked in Paint and Care Home, I think. She said to me, "Now you can smell cancer, Mr. Halpin." Now, I have a very poor sense of smell, but she said she could smell it. And I know why, too. Actually, I'll tell you that in a minute. But I know that dogs can smell cancer. Do you know that? They can. And the reason why you can smell cancer is that many tumours undergo necrosis, death, within the mass of the tumour. And that is like the smell of death. dead tissue. So that will be in the bloodstream and maybe even the sweat. So I although I would like to know more about that, the chemistry of it, I can imagine that is true.
I mean, in a normal world, you might think that one of the first things in any kind of cancer diagnosis clinic would be a beagle sitting there ready to sniff you as you came in.
Yes, but the thing is that you see that all these things, there's the cart's put before the horse all the time. You say, now, people, do you know now they're talking about blood tests to detect cancer? Well, you can do that, you see. But I'll tell you one case. I had one of my many good mentors was Robin Ling up at Exeter. He, in fact, designed with an engineer the Exeter hip, which is used apparently in about a third of all cases worldwide. Robin had some urinary trouble. He had a thing called a PAS. Do you know what that stands for? Prostate-specific antigen. PSA, sorry, not PSA, not PS, PSA. It picks up in the blood test that the patient is making antigens against the tumour, prostate tumour. His was normal. So I think he was reassured. I can't remember the circumstances. But the fact is that he had a very active prostate cancer, what we call anaplastic. It was very, the cells would have been primitive, and it was growing fast, probably. But this doesn't produce the antigen which the blood test tests for. So he was, so there was a false, there was an aura of security when there wasn't. He ended up, in fact, with radiation to the prostate. That damaged his rectum. He had fecal frequency. And he ended up with an ileal loop. That is, they had to divert this large bowel into the ileum, bring it out in the front of his tummy. So, and he had a terribly rough time. Not treated very well at all, poor Robin.
Well, what make of this, one of the new, we hear on the news, the BBC raging about the idea of a new vaccine against cancer?
Ah, well, that raises the issue. Well, it's a rather broad-ranging interview, this, but Fergus Walsh, comes on. He's a rather rat-faced chap who comes on. He's a health correspondent or some similar title like that. He's always got some new thing to talk about. Usually there's been no proper controlled trial, and it's just distracting people with the idea that medicine has all sorts of clever tricks to help them, rather than getting your weight down or having nourishing food cooked at home rather than being a mini meal in some damn supermarket.
He seems to know how to read out a GlaxoSmithKline press release very well.
Ah, he made it. Do you know, is that so? Well, I'll tell you why. Do you know what his wife does? She was a GP. I think her name is Bernadette. She's a CEO or something like that in the Benelux countries for SmithKline French. And I wrote to him once saying, would you please announce your conflict of interest when you're talking about medical matters on the BBC? Of course, I get no reply from the BBC ever. That's why there's about 50 references to the BBC on my website, which is dhalpin.infoaction.org.uk. There's about 50 references to the health service, same number for community hospitals, same number for Dr. Kelly, who is yet to have an inquest 21 years after his unnatural death. That's a sign that we are living in a lawless country with lawless people running it, Sunak heading it up previously, and now a frank fascist running the so-called Labour government.
So that's the one and only Dr. David Halpin, retired, now living down in Devon. Some interesting stuff, particularly about, he's diagnosed thousands of people for cancer. He's one of those people that's part of what his job was, is finding out what's wrong with people. And he's saying, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, no one, of course, will listen to David Halpin, except you and I. But I suppose his main point, Martin, really, is about the demise of healthcare and things like basic changes to the rules about death certificates and inquests.
Well, obviously, I mean, that was a very wide-ranging discussion across a large...
Yeah, and there's more where that came from as well. So I'll put a full link, a link up to the full version of that interview, which is best part of an hour, on thisweek.org.uk tonight. But yes, wide-ranging, and we go wherever the conversation takes us, I'm afraid. But anyway, what do you make of this problem that we now seem to have, particularly post-COVID, with the rules really being changed around death certificates and inquests?
Well, obviously, I'm not a medical person, so I don't know the full detail. But what I am, I'm just an ordinary punter, and I cannot get a National Health Service dentist, and I'm not the only one. When I was a child, dentists used to come into the schools and check everybody's teeth. Now, unless your parents pay for it, you can't have dental care.
Do you think maybe some of the 2 billion or so from King Charles might be able to pay for that, mightn't it?
Yeah, well, we could stop the war in Ukraine. We could stop supplying weaponry to the Israelis. We could, having bailed the banks out, we could nationalise the banks. We could turn the whole of the Crown Estate into public property. Just think of all the money coming into the Crown Estate. And then we could reduce taxes as well. Gosh, but we don't do any of that, do we?
One of the most important places where King Charles, we've already mentioned things like the army officers being appointed by the king, the police chiefs being appointed by the king, the judges being appointed by the king. But what about the directors of the BBC? Well, again, what happens is that the king will present a list of potentials to a minister. The minister will say tick, tick, tick. But of course, all these ministers now are very, very pliable, and they themselves have to be approved by the king. So yeah, he's getting, I think, much, much more power than people realise, far more. And when it came to his divorce with Princess Diana, there are a couple of very good books, one by John Morgan, another one by Neil Botham, I think is his name, about the murder of Diana, the assassination of Princess Diana. So we're going to finish before the break looking at that. And for me, one of the most important things to do with the broadcasting of the BBC is the way that the Martin Bashir interview has been massaged by the establishment to be somehow wrong. Actually, no, it wasn't wrong, and Diana most definitely wanted to do it and approved of it. But King Charles doesn't want the BBC to ever license or use that again, because they apparently control the copyrights. They don't want anyone using it. So this is a great fun thing to do, is to share that interview, to find it online and to share it wherever you can, because there's a massive attempt to suppress it. And also, of course, to demonise Martin Bashir, who did a fairly good job. Anyway, last year there was an inquiry into this. So let's have a listen to the former Director Generals of the BBC. I think it's Tony Hall and John Burt. Or maybe one of them was just the head of news, talking about this at a government inquiry, where they explain a lot of the things to do with that Diana interview, but also some of the background. So, for example, that the BBC Panorama documentary with Diana being interviewed started its life as an investigation into the King using MI5 and GCHQ to spy on Princess Diana.
Did it ring any alarm bells at all, Lord Burt?
No, absolutely none. I mean, I think you can overstate the junior. He's in his early 30s. He's worked in the BBC a number of years. He's worked on other current affairs programme. He's risen up the ranks to Panorama. What I did understand and is embedded in my memory is that he didn't. I mean, I think he probably did set out to get an interview with Princess Diana, but that's not the story that was being told. What he set out was to make a panorama on the surveillance of Princess Diana's royal family. Not an unreasonable thing to do, because remember, in the previous couple of years, two private phone calls, one from Princess Diana, one from Prince Charles, had been intercepted and published. So it wasn't fanciful to assume that there were difficulties around surveillance and bugging of members of the royal family. And my understanding is that was the journey he set out on.
Well, personally, I don't think that this is affecting the lads at all. They're very mature, they're well-trained. The father's really done a good job in sorting them out. And whatever their mother does is immaterial. Oh, they're well ahead of the time. Of course they are. They're well trained in what they are. They're well trained for what they are. It makes no difference to them. They're mature at their age. They're well aware of this.
You've had experience of them. You've been... Don't forget, I
know more about these kids and Diana than any of you.
How?
Because I was a bloke that spied on it. I was the one who was watching her, catching her out, doing things with Hewitt.
Who for?
No comment.
What do you mean, no comment? I'll get away with that.
Doing it for a range. I was a Royal Marine. I was tasked to do something to find out what Diana was really...
Oh, so she's not paranoid then?
No, it's true.
No,
exactly.
She's not.
Oh, I see. So it is. So we were spying on her.
Of course we were.
So, of course we were. Of course we were spying on her. Well, that's what Martin Bashir first of all set out to do. I suppose, Martin, you know, as we heard last week, the idea of mass surveillance is kind of okay, but it seemed to create much more of a hoo-ha when the mass surveillance was on Diana and Charles, particularly Diana, through the divorce case, for example, because Charles is in charge of all these military intelligence agencies, and if he wanted to abuse his power, he could just simply use them, as he did do, to spy on his wife to make sure he had an advantage through the divorce. But I mean, this what it shows us here, I think, is almost a kind of medieval style king who's using his various offices and obviously paid for by the public to further his own interests.
Well, I'm willing to accept that he's got more power than he ought to have, and maybe we shouldn't have a king at all. But on the other hand, the idea that we're all being surveyed all the time, and Princess Diana must have realised she was being surveyed. No doubt Martin McGuinness realised he was being surveyed. People are surveyed. And it's been going on for quite a long time, and it's very. How are we going to deal with that? I don't know.
Well, Kevin Carhill's been looking into this for quite a long time, and
yes.
As part of the interview I did with him yesterday, he talked about this whole idea of of mass surveillance, and particularly this whole idea of the lawsuits against Google and his own lawsuits, which apparently are being picked up now.
The mass surveillance in the UK is criminal and unlawful, and you're hearing it here properly for the first time. At the moment, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal of the High Court of England and Wales has actually accepted and is looking at a case complaining about mass surveillance in the UK. And the last time I made that application, the court actually granted my application. So I'm moderately optimistic. But certainly the court has accepted the application. It hasn't rejected it. And in that application, the people who are responsible for the mass surveillance in the UK, the Information Commissioner and the police, they're responsible in the sense. When Parliament told them this was happening and it was criminal, they did nothing. And that the High Court now has the case. And I can tell you here, and you won't hear it anywhere else, the case before the High Court has been referred to the Privy Council. How about that?
So that's Kevin Carhill there explaining, and you'll hear much more about that if you want to have a listen to the full interview at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. Now, it's almost, I do feel sometimes, Martin, that Kevin is fighting almost like a one-man battle against this criminal mass surveillance, and the courts are kind of saying, yes, we'll look into it, and then doing nothing.
Well, because it's in the US Constitution that they're not supposed, for example, that they're not supposed to spy on any US citizen unless they've got a warrant because they're suspected of criminal activity or national security is involved. But of course, modern technology allows mass surveillance. And so the intelligence services have just been engaging in mass surveillance, just as Facebook does. It's not an intelligence agency, but they can see what everybody on Facebook's doing at the push of a button. And this is, of course, this technology has gone far more powerful than, you know, because in 1776, you know, what they were talking about was, interfering with the post. But obviously modern technology allows lots of people, not just the state, to spy on people. And, you know, the law simply hasn't caught up with any of that, has it?
No, it hasn't. Just before the break, Susan Wojcicki, former YouTube chief, died aged 56. So she was the person ultimately responsible for closing down my public inquiry channel, which had been putting on their warnings about the potential problems, particularly with the COVID vaccine. So the censor has died at age 56. A lot of people suggesting that she's died possibly because of her jabs that she's had herself. Anyway, certainly very, very early to die. A post by her husband, Dennis Tropper, said she'd lived with non-small cell lung cancer for 2 years. He gave no other information, including the location of her death. So we know very, very little about where she's died, but certainly extremely sad to see someone dying so early, and certainly somebody who's been so instrumental in censoring medical information on YouTube.
We shall
in Georgia's hill, A ragged band, they called the diggers, came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell here for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroying their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.
I stayed off work all day the day I met you, darling, and instead we spent the morning in the park and the afternoon in bed. But by the tea time we were hungry, I went to shop for you. The butcher took a fiver for a porterhouse for two. I'll be blowed, I'll be blowed, the butcher was a twister. I'll be damned, he only gave us change of a quid. I was done, the porterhouse was bristle. He says, open up your eyes, he says, and learn to do as I did. Open up your eyes, he says, and learn to do as I did. They can do me, darling, I have nothing else to lose. Him and his boxy porterhouse can cheat me if they choose. They can do me, darling, as they do. The pussy-footing butcher man would laugh aloud if he knew that since you took my eyes, they do not do as others do. The day before your birthday I was miserably broke, mooching up a ginnel when this military bloke comes up and says he'll give us a sub to buy a flower or two for you. He hands me down a shilling and I signs an IOU. I'll be blowed, the soldier was a scoundrel. I'll be damned, and the shilling was a dud. I was done, I joined the sorting army with a rifle in your hand. He says you'll do as everyone would, a rifle in your hand and you will do as everyone would. They can do me, darling, I have nothing else to lose. Him and his piffling rifle can dragoon me if they choose. They can do me, darling, they can do me as they do. The scoundrel of a corporal would chuckle if he knew that since you held my hand, it does not do as others do. I was trained at scaling obstacles and marching every day. I got good enough to scale the barracks wall and march away. But the bloodhounds came and got me, and they said if I confessed, the justice of the peace would smile on me and do his best. I'll be blowed, the magistrate was bogey. I'll be damned, he usually gave a year or two. I was done, he did his best to give me 20. With a chain about your feet, he says, you'll do as others do. A chain about your feet, he says, now do as others do. They can do me, darling, I have nothing else to lose.
Him and his petty fogger, he can shackle me if they choose. They can do me, darling, as they do. The tricky old juridical would snicker if he knew that since you kissed my feet, they do not do as others do. A bishop came to see as I languished in the cell. Give us a blessing and asked if I was short of anything else. And I said that I was thirsty, so we went and got a cup. Looks at me and nods and I politely drink it up. I'll be blowed. The bishop was a rascal. I'll be damned. And him a bishop, if you please. I was done. In the cup was holy water. You're a Christian now, you are, he says. So down upon your knees. Now a proper Christian, so down upon your knees. They can do me, darling, I have nothing else to lose. Him and his holy water trick can save me if they choose. They can do me, darling, as they do. The rascally Episcopal would giggle if he knew that since you touch my knees, they do not do as others do. And then a bony angel with a hammer and some wings came and said that I could see you again if I went to live with him. So I said yes, and so he hit me with his hammer a time or two. He took me to his mansion. On the doorstep there was you. I'll be blown. The angel was a bounder. I'll be damned. He took you up the stairs. I was done. He threw me down the boiler house. There's one born every minute, he says. We keep them all in there. One born every minute, he says. We keep them all down there. They can do me, darling. I have nothing else to lose. Him and his crematorium can grill me if they choose. They can do me, darling, as they do. The dangerous old angel face would frown a bit if he knew that since you took me in, I do not do as others do.
Well, they don't make them like that anymore. That's Jake Thackeray, 1973, I think. And before that, we heard Dick Gochan, The World Turned Upside Down. At the start, it's Joan Byers. That was from the 1960s, I think 64 or something. Would you believe on the BBC? Well, of course, you wouldn't hear anything like that anymore. In fact, I would imagine that she's banned from the BBC nowadays, that evil Joan Byers. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I think we better start, Martin, with this business over in Gaza. I mean, it's been particularly horrendous, but you know, there has actually been here in Bristol some action against it, which is this ram raiding of the Elbit headquarters up at Filton here. Maybe we could just start by looking at that, because there's just been more announcements today. Three more have been charged over the ram raid attack on Elbit systems, so that's just popped up in the Bristol Post today. Seven have already been charged, and a demonstration of supporters for what are now being called the Elbit Seven is happening tomorrow on Saturday in the city centre. The Filton Ten, I think they're now calling them, so there's been more arrests. Anyway, what do you make of this sort of action? The idea that, you know, you're going to ram your way into a Elbit factory here in Bristol. It could be potentially counterproductive, maybe.
I think that's what worries me about this. I mean, we had our friend Martin on earlier talking about the Committee of 100. And, of course, the mainstream CND always kept their distance from the Committee of 100. The Committee of 100 engages in direct action. Mainstream CND just lobbies MPs and marches and protests. And there was a kind of division of labour there, if you like. And I suppose that's the same sort of thing we've had with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, its allied forces, you know, Muslim Council of Britain, CND again involved. But the Palestine Action is a non-democratic structure. You know, you can join it, but, you know, those who aren't part of it don't get any say in it, and it's not quite clear how they make decisions. Now, that opens up the possibility of infiltration and therefore also the possibility of manipulation.
Mm. Well, that's of course. But I mean, you know, what about this principle that you can have a sort of civic society group like Palestine Solidarity Campaign or one of the other ones, and a direct action group of no real connection with each other, but they're just they're both having similar aims. Just forget about the infiltration for a minute. What about the principle?
Well, okay. Well, I mean, but the point is, up to now, Palestine Action have taken what you might call open civil disobedience actions. You know, they've locked onto things, they've sprayed things, they've allowed.
They're not open. No, they're turning up in the middle of the night and breaking in and spraying things red.
Other of the stuff they have done has been more traditional Greenpeace-style direct action. This is another step. I'm not saying that those involved are wrong. No doubt they think they are right, because, of course, children are dying every day. And maybe it's enough now.
What about this idea that what they're doing is defensible because they're stopping a greater crime?
Well, that's presumably what they will argue when they get to court. Well,
they probably won't be allowed to argue it. But anyway, look, the latest is the three have all been charged with criminal damage and aggravated burglary. One has also been charged with violent disorder in connection with the action at defence technology firm Elbit System in Filton, North Bristol, early this month. The three joined seven others who've also been charged following the action on August the 6th. Now, I suppose, aggravated burglary, really?
Well, I mean, there's some other Palestine activists who've been charged with terrorism, not in Bristol. You can see that the state has got quite a number of different ways to try and approach this in terms of what it's going to charge people with. We'll have to see how this plays out. I think in the terms of general public opinion, the police, as you say, as you mentioned last week, said that they came with sledgehammers and weaponry, you know, tools to cause damage, criminal damage, but they also had a whip. And you can't cause criminal damage with a whip. That was just presumably to hit people with. But we don't.
And there's a bit of a whiff of complaints from the local police here. It says, despite happening in Filton, the investigation into the attack on Elbit Systems is being led by Counter-Terrorism Policing South East, which sounds like some sort of agency, but really, of course, it's connected with MI5. This anything to do with counter-terrorism and that Met, you know, is MI5. Their spokesperson said the Crown Prosecution Service, and they didn't even give their names, these so-called government officials, the Crown Prosecution Service will be submitting to the court that these offences have a terrorist connection. Now, is this over-egging the pudding possibly here? I mean, is it terrorism to go in and smash up drones inside a factory?
It is over-egging the pudding because there's perfectly good existing laws which don't include terrorism that you could charge people with. And, of course, the question has to be, are any of the people that rioted from the right wing, are they going to be charged with terrorism? Because if you're going to start charging people with terrorism, you've got to charge them evenly and fairly, as was supposedly went on in Northern Ireland. So if you're a loyalist terrorist, you get charged with terrorism. If you're a Republican terrorist, you get charged with terrorism. If you are Brigadier Gordon Kerr running the Force Research Unit, who's running agents in both the loyalist and the provisional IRA, you get charged with terrorism because the law is above everything, all of that. But if you're going to charge one lot with terrorism and the other lot with criminal damage or, you know, causing an affray, why the one lot get charged with terrorism and the other lot not? It's two-tier policing, Tony. That's what that means.
Well, tomorrow lunchtime in Bristol City Centre, there will be a demonstration in support of these people who've been arrested allegedly for committing these offences. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But, of course, the main events of the week from Gaza are not the wonderful David Lammy having his little trip over there, but they are this horrific attack. What do you make of that? It's 100 people killed whilst praying in a school.
Well, it's what the Israeli deep state is doing is they're trying to provoke a wider war so that they can drag the United States and Britain in to that wider war. And people in Britain need to be very well aware of this. They're relying on the RAF at Akrotiri to bomb Lebanon for them. But, of course, as Hezbollah have made it quite clear, if RAF planes are used to bomb us, we are going to fire back at Akrotiri, the airbase that Britain has in Cyprus. Most people in Britain probably don't even know we have an airbase there. And, of course, the people of Cyprus do not want that airbase there. They fought a war against us in the 1950s to drive us out. And in order to get their independence in 1962, they had to accept Britain having an airbase on their territory. Now, I think somebody like Nigel Farage would understand this is a sovereignty issue for the Cypriots. It's a sovereignty issue. You cannot use our territory to make war in the Middle East. But we are. And, of course, if we do, then British military personnel are going to end up dead. And then, of course, Keir Starmer is going to turn around and say, well, we've got to go to war with Lebanon now. But I think he's going to find that most people in this country are not prepared to go to war to protect genocidal Israel, who are already in the dock at the International Criminal Court.
Al Jazeera this week reported on the emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss this hideous attack on the school while people were praying by Benjamin Netanyahu's army, the Israeli Defense Force.
When it comes to Gaza, the contradictions of what the United States says at the United Nations versus what it does in Washington was laid bare during an emergency Security Council meeting in response to Israel's attack on Saturday at a school where Palestinian civilians were sheltering, killing nearly 100 of them.
We mourn every civilian lost in this horrific incident and in this conflict.
At the very moment the meeting was taking place, news came that Washington signed off on a new $20 billion military sales deal with Israel. The atmosphere in the council chamber was tense after the Israeli ambassador claimed his country is
the most moral country in the world. You listen, Palestinian representative.
And then personally attacked both the Palestinian and Algerian representatives. Algeria took the floor again.
Que les 16,000 enfants.
I want to testify here that the 16,000 children who have been killed since the 7th of October didn't kill themselves.
Israel's ambassador then walked out as he was speaking. Resolution 2735, adopted by the council in June and ordering a ceasefire, has been ignored as Israel continues its attacks on Gaza. By the UN's count, bombing 21 shelters since early July.
This council has a responsibility to end the impunity with which Israel has been carrying out its atrocities against the Palestinian people. It flies in the face of everything that the United Nations is built on: peace and security, human rights, and sustainable development. We cannot allow this to continue.
Show some bravery. Take actions. Stop the criminals in getting away with murder.
It's clear frustrations are beginning to boil over after more than 20 emergency Security Council meetings on Gaza in the past 10 months have failed to end the genocide. Frustration that the captives have not been released, that Israel continues to act with impunity, and that the U.S. continues to provide arms to the very country doing most of the killing. Gabriel Elizondo, Al Jazeera, at the United Nations in New York.
Ironic, isn't it, Martin, that the Americans are just approving all these billions for more weapons?
Well, at the same time as pretending to care about the deaths of these children. The world can see the hypocrisy of it all. Meanwhile, wagging the finger at the evil Putin. And, of course, the Ukrainian forces inside Russia have been killing civilians. Evidence has come to light. And the whole policy there is to terrorize the Russian population so they'll realize that Putin can't protect them, and then they'll rise up against him. The hypocrisy of it all is absolutely apparent to people sitting in Niger, for example, or South Africa, or Venezuela. I mean, the West is just totally hypocritical.
The journalists have actually been telling Blinken to stop these weapons transfers, which is nice to see the journalists at least attempting to do something there. That's on antiwar.com. At least someone's doing something, Martin. The antiwar.com website has joined 19 other news outlets, 7 press freedom organisations and 113 journalists in a letter. I think we should be signing this letter too, Martin. In a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, calling for the US to end weapons transfers to Israel, stop supporting the slaughter of Palestinians. It was initiated by something called the Courage Foundation, Defending Rights and Dissent, and Roots Action and focuses on the Israeli targeting of journalists in Gaza. Since the 7th of October 23, Israel's killed more than 160 Palestinian journalists. This is the largest recording number of journalists killed in any war. While Israel's indiscriminate bombing of the densely populated Gaza means no civilians are safe, Israel has also been repeatedly documented deliberately targeting journalists. The letter notes, the mass killing in Gaza would not be possible without US weapons and support. So at least I suppose journalists are doing something. And our very own journalist we're going to hear from now is Wafa Aludaini. She sent me another report this week from Gaza itself.
Hello everyone, this is Wafa Aludaini, Gaza-based journalist. I'm reporting to you about the latest update from the Gaza Strip. More than 10 months into the Israeli genocide, vast swathes of Gaza lay in ruin amid a crippling blockade of food, clean water and medicine. The Palestinian death toll has risen to 40,005, with at least 92,400 injured amid relentless Israeli attack on Gaza since last October. Thousands of massacres were committed, particularly against the displaced families and the displacement zones. One of the horrible massacres was targeting the Tabarin school massacre, where at least 100 displaced Palestinians were killed and hundreds others were injured and maimed. After the Israeli occupation warplanes fired two guided missiles at the mosque at time of dawn prayer, while hundreds were praying, tens of martyrs' bodies, including kids, were not found or found shattered into parts on the ground. The Israeli occupation forces released names of 30 Palestinians that they said had been killed in the strike and alleged that they were Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad militants. But the list, after verifying by Palestinians, they found that two of alleged militants had been killed a few days earlier in different areas of Gaza. Several relatives of the victim alleged by Israel to be militants denied these accusations and described the victims as Beit Hanun Hospital Administration Director, retired principal, a scholar of Arabic language and literature, and a man who was killed in last December. This is not a mere incident. It was the fifth attack on a sheltering school just in a week. The UN Human Rights Office said it was horrified by unfolding pattern of attacks on a school. An Al Jazeera investigation found that the bombing was deliberately performed to result in a maximum casualties. A CNN weapon expert identified shrapnel evident in footage from the aftermath of the attack as coming from the U.S. This is Wafa Aludaini reporting from the Gaza Strip, Palestine, for Not the PCFM Politics Show. Hope to speak to you soon again.
Well, we hope to speak to you too. God bless you, Wafa. Amazing little report there. Of course, these figures that she's just dropping in there, Martin, it's been in the main news this week. 40,000 civilians now been massacred by the Israelis. But she mentions the other figure, which is the injured, 92,500.
Well, I mean, these are massive underestimates, aren't they? This is the so-called Hamas health ministry. You know, that's their figures. But these are the people that they can definitely identify as dead. But thousands and thousands of people are dead under the rubble. They've gone missing. And you can presume they're dead. Because if they weren't dead, you'd be able to find where they were. So, I mean, The Lancet reckons at least 180,000, and others reckon more than that. And don't forget, polio is now about to break out because of the destruction of the water supply. And, of course, the fact that they've been starving, starvation is going to kick in. And our government is supporting the people who are doing this. And we're about to go to war with Iran and Hezbollah, who are fighting on the side of Hamas, to try and end this thing. There's supposedly been negotiations in Doha today about a ceasefire. And I understand the Iranian government and the Hezbollah people have said, if the Israelis agree to a ceasefire, we will forego any revenge for what you did to our people last week. And that's why they're waiting to see what will happen. Hamas's position, Sinjar is inside the tunnels. He said, we've already said what the deal is. The Israelis agreed to it some weeks ago. That's the deal. We're not negotiating anymore. Sign up to that deal. That's the deal we want. And we'll be prepared to go through a ceasefire on that basis. Otherwise, we're going to fight on. And of course, they've got the absolute right to fight on. They're the elected government of their country. They won in 2006. They've got more political support now than they've ever had right across Palestine. So there's no doubt whatsoever if there's an election, they would win. And they are fighting to the finish now. What I think the Iranians and Hezbollah need to do is, if we've reached a point where they aren't prepared to have a ceasefire, it's time to take down the Israeli army. You've got the means.
Well, there certainly is the means out there. China's UN envoy, Martin, UN has condemned Israel for the heinous Gaza school massacre, a heinous act. China's UN representative condemned Israel at the UN Security Council. But the Chinese aren't actually doing anything, are they? They're a superpower.
They are. Don't forget, they're a long way away. The Chinese army can't directly intervene in this. They've got people on the ground in Syria working with the Syrian Arab army, and they have had for a long time. They've got people in Iran talking to the Iranian military. Yeah? And if it comes to a fight, the Russians and the Chinese will back their allies in Iran and in Lebanon. And, of course, we will back our allies, the United States, and we will fight on behalf of the people who are killing these children. And, of course, that makes British military personnel and political leaders like Haniyeh, who are, if political leaders like that can be whacked, and it's okay to whack political leaders like that, then our political leaders are absolutely fair game. Fair game.
Yeah, the Al-Tabin School. The school is the Al-Tabin School. That's T-A-B-E-I-N, where this horrific massacre took place. Now, those who were trying to clear up the bodies and to try and identify anybody that might possibly be saved and take them to hospital, etc., found that was a very difficult task, and that eventually what they had to do was just literally get body parts, put them in plastic bags and hand them to relatives, because many, many of the victims, many of them children, simply could not be identified, and even body parts couldn't be put with one another because they were just strewn all over the place, these people, the dead bodies. It's maybe why Wafa, in the middle of her report there, she had to pause and send a second part of it, because it was so horrific for somebody who lives there to describe what has happened to these innocent people.
Well, and it's quite deliberate as well. I mean, sometimes in wars, all wars, innocent people get killed. And it's not deliberate. It's just, collateral damage, as we used to say when we were bombing Iraq. It'll be for their own good in the end, but of course, this is actually quite deliberate. And they even openly say, I mean, Smotrich is saying we should starve them to death. Now, how much more do these people have to say before we realise what they're intending to do is kill all of these people, and we are supporting them. Now, what we should be doing is going to war with them, like we were at war with them in the 1940s, when the state was created. The state of Israel was created through violence. That's the only reason why they got a state and why they were given one is because
there was also a vote
violent
at the United Nations, wasn't there? With Victor, hang on a minute, Martin, you're interrupting there. You have to let me finish my sentences, please. I know you're being a little bit too on top. I know you're upset about this, but back in 1948, when the vote took place at the UN, what you had was Victor Rothschild getting the Russians and their related countries' votes to create the State of Israel. And then you got Nelson Rockefeller over in the United States telling Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, saying basically you can have vengeance against the Nazis or a country, but not both. I can only deliver enough votes for you to get this vote at the UN to create the State of Israel if you relinquish any claim to going after Nazi war criminals after World War II. So it was a whole nasty piece of work to get that thing through the UN as well. But at the same time, in fact, I think it was the previous year, the Geneva Conventions were signed, aren't they? So the basic tenets of the Geneva Conventions are two fundamental ones. One is that you treat your enemy soldiers, once they've surrendered, well, and just stick them in prison camps, much of which, of course, happened on the Western Front in Second World War, and also, of course, that you protect civilians. Now, these Geneva Conventions, I think in a way what's happened is, with this particular war in Gaza, maybe to a lesser extent in Ukraine, but particularly in Gaza here, the Israelis have thrown all of these decisions made after World War II with the Geneva Conventions out of the window. And the Radio New Zealand this week did a report on this. I didn't see much about the 75th anniversary of the signing of these Geneva Conventions anywhere in the British press, but at least Radio New Zealand covered it, and here's what they had to say.
The idea was that we would reconcile the clash between military necessity and humanity to protect the vulnerable and stop unnecessary suffering. And this involves the principle of distinction, that we try to make a difference between civilians and combatants, and that when military use or force is utilized, it's proportionate to the objective that they're trying to achieve.
Okay. In the Ukraine war in Gaza and the preceding October attack on Israel, there have been murder, mutilation, torture, the taking of hostages, rape, intentional attacks against civilian populations, intentional attacks against hospitals, schools. So can I return to that earlier question? What use are the Geneva Conventions if perpetrators can only be brought to book sometime in the future? That seems like diminished disincentive if these cases could take years and years to get to the bottom of, possibly.
Well, if you look at something like the International Criminal Court, which began its work in 2002, you've had 11 convictions and 4 acquittals, which, to be honest, is not a lot of numbers. But it's not just about those people. It's also about getting the record straight for posterity and also hearing the voices of the victims.
When the Ukraine war stops and some sort of peace is negotiated, can peace be brokered on the condition that war crimes can be absolved?
We're in a very difficult point right now because the International Criminal Court, for its first few decades, focused upon African countries and not the larger ones. We're at the time now where we may have to make very difficult decisions because there's no chance of a peace with Russia if Mr. Putin's endpoint is a prison cell in the Netherlands. However, if we make an exception to this, you will find a very selective type of international justice coming into the future.
Okay, so that's a difficult situation. You have a situation in Gaza where Israel knows that civilians will die in its attacks. Its argument, although it's never phrased this way, is that if Hamas hides among civilian populations, what else do you do to destroy them, basically? How much precedence does this have in war, please, particularly since the Geneva Conventions were agreed to?
There is a very strong presumption that areas with civilians in them should not be targeted, but it's not absolute. So whether you've got schools or whether you've got hospitals, that protection can be made irrelevant if it's suddenly got military personnel or military equipment in it. The problem is it doesn't become a chance to do whatever you want in those areas. The response must still be proportionate, and you must still try to achieve distinction between the civilians and the combatants.
So that's Radio New Zealand this week, Martin. These Geneva Conventions don't seem to be worth the paper they're written on, certainly if you're living in Gaza.
Well, I mean, the fact that we've got the aspiration to do that is okay. You know, we might as well keep the aspiration, even if we, in practice it's not carried through.
I mean, all those people that died, the British that died in the Second World War and other nations fighting Hitler, surely they died for these things like this Geneva Convention, didn't they?
They did, and also, of course, coming back to the recognition of the State of Israel, it was not recognised. There was a partition plan, and two states were supposed to be created. They immediately went to war and captured far more land than they'd been offered, and they were offered more land than they deserved anyway. So there's a whole question about whether there should be a State of Israel at all. Algérie française is finished. It's in the dustbin of history. Maybe Israel is going to end up the same.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be... Yeah, sorry, go on.
The thing about the Geneva Convention is, look at the Bucha massacre. Yeah, that was presented in the Western media as the awful Russian soldiers carried out this terrible massacre of these people.
Yeah, it's pronounced Bucha massacre. They pronounce it anyway.
Bucha, yeah, it was exactly at the same time as when Boris Johnson turned up and told Zelensky to fight on. So it's quite clear, to my mind, that British intelligence were probably involved in what happened there, and it was the massacre all the evidence is piling up, was carried out by the SBU, the Ukrainian Secrets Police, and the Azov Battalion, no doubt advised by British military advisers. Now, if we're going to send Putin to the criminal courts, the British military advisers that were wrong in the Bucha massacre, they have to go. Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who ran both the loyalist paramilitaries and the toughest people inside the IRA, they were all his agents. He has to go to prison for 25 years, doesn't he? You can't say that we're going to put the Russians in prison if we're not going to put the Israelis in prison and put our own people in prison.
Yeah, well, one of the problems...
The three SASs of New Zealand, Australia and Britain are involved in war crimes in Afghanistan.
One of the problems...
They need, and their officers
One
need
of the problems with the International Criminal Court... Martin, one of the problems with the International Criminal Court is that you've got basically... black African leaders being prosecuted. So it's just another thing from colonial days.
In the world at large, that's how it's regarded. Yeah? What you do...
But the International Court of Justice is separate. Anyway, that's separate.
So,
just looking at the evidence for what is this achieving for the Israelis, these breaking of these Geneva Conventions and committing all these war crimes and these horrific massacres. The United States is saying Israeli bombing Gaza will kill more civilians, but it won't defeat Hamas. US intelligence officials speaking in the New York Times this week said that Israel will not be able to defeat Hamas and continue to bomb Gaza will kill more civilians. Some will, of course, kill hostages too. Some national security officials expressed surprise at how much Israel has degraded Hamas over the 10-month onslaught, but acknowledged that the Israel Defense Forces cannot prevent the Palestinian group's reorganization. According to the Times, Israel's achieved all that it can militarily in Gaza, according to senior American officials who say continued bombings are only increasing risk to civilians, Martin.
Well, that's because you've got people inside the US government who are professionals, either diplomats or military, who know that they're, Hamas has basically not been militarily defeated at all. But that's not the point from the point of view of the right wing in Israel. They just want all the Palestinians dead or expelled. They're quite clear. It's not even a secret. That's what they want. And that's why they're quite happy. I mean, somebody from the German government this week was saying that the killings in this school this week were justified because Israel had a right to self-defense. That's absurd. In actual fact, people in Germany who are supporting this, they need to be sent to The Hague. Yeah? Maybe they need to do 25 years in prison. And of course, at the end of the Second World War, lots of people in Germany were let off. Because, like Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo, he heads up the BND, and therefore he's not punished at all. Stepan Bandera, who killed thousands and thousands of Jews and Poles and Russians, he lived out his life as a free man in Germany until the KGB assassinated him in 1959. Now, should the KGB be assassinating people? Probably not. But if you're not going to put them on trial... What's the alternative?
Yeah, well, that's quite. I can totally understand that point of view. Anyway, good old Britain's Foreign Secretary David Lammy has been over now. He's right now over in Israel, apparently trying to broker a ceasefire. Although I don't think he's really going to get very far, of course, because he's not. Maybe he's threatening. Do you think he is, Martin, to say unless you do a ceasefire, we're going to stop allowing arms to go from Britain? Do you think he might be saying that to Netanyahu and his friends?
Well. I have my doubts. I mean, he's not talking to Hamas, is he? Because they're terrorists, so we don't talk to them. So he's only talking to the Israelis. I think some people in the West, no doubt the British Labour government, would love there to be a ceasefire so that this would all go away. And then they could just say, well, thank goodness that's all over. Let's get on with, keeping children poor. But in actual fact, that's not what's going to happen. The Israelis want a war and they want us in it. And they're not going to stop because it's in for a penny, in for a pound, as far as they're concerned. And ultimately, this is going to be a major war. As I said earlier, what needs to happen now is the Russian forces, the Syrian army, Hezbollah, the Houthi, or the Nasrallah, and the Iranians, they need to start whacking the Israeli army and their allies. If the Americans and the British join in, whack them as well. No, don't go,
Martin, just a minute, because surely this is it, Martin. This is exactly what the Israelis want.
Well, it may be what they want, but it's what they're bruising for. So what we're going to do is going to lie down and let them do all of this, are we? I don't think we are. I'm not a pacifist.
We'll be hearing a bit from Peter Ford in a minute, the former ambassador to Syria, see what he has to say about that. But before that, let's hear from our very own Foreign Secretary David Lammy over in Jerusalem.
Look, can I say how important it has been to travel here and be here with my French colleague, Minister Segonet, to hear and to bring a message here to Israel. I am pleased that the reports out of Qatar suggest that the first day of hostage talks has gone well, and it has been important to listen to ministers here in Israel and hear too from them that they hope that we are on the cusp of a deal. This is a war and a crisis that has taken so many lives across the region, and that of course began with the most horrific of events on October the 7th. But as we head now to 315 days of war, the time for a deal, for those hostages to be returned, for aid to get in the quantities that are necessary in Gaza, and for the fighting to stop is now. And of course, that is the message that we have jointly underlined to ministers today, both in Israel and, of course, in the occupied territories.
So that's Foreign Secretary David Lammy speaking of Bilderberger, of course, speaking of who, by the way, it was quite entertaining when we were in Bilderberg last year with Charlie, etc., to watch him trying to get into the Bilderberg conference with all these financiers and the NATO people, including the Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, in this hotel, this kind of Fourth Reich secret conference that Lammy was trying to get into, and they wouldn't let him in, Martin. He was stood there for about 5 minutes trying to argue with them, saying, look, I'm David Lammy, let me in. A security wouldn't let him in, and then he had to go and hide behind a bush in a nearby street, various of us took photographs of him there, and eventually he managed to convince someone inside on the phone to let him in. And so this is the sort of situation that people like him are in. He is definitely not running the show, and he's not even really there talking about any potential measures against Israel if they carry on slaughtering people. He even calls it a war, doesn't he? Whereas actually, since October the 7th, what's been going on is a mass slaughter and war crimes.
Well, it is a mass slaughter and a war crime, but that in a sense is a war, because it didn't start on October the 7th. I mean, the people in Gaza had the March for Justice, or whatever they called it, where people peacefully tried to leave the Gaza Strip and they were all shot down. Loads and loads of them, hundreds of them. And, you know, nobody did anything. Now, ultimately, as I said earlier, I'm not a pacifist, nor are you, Tony, if you look into your heart of hearts.
Yes, I am.
All right, well, in that case, I'm not. Okay, or not?
We have a few differences, Martin. That's one of them, and I think, you know, from a general point of view, what the Israelis want is they want desperately want the Iranians and the Lebanese in the form of Hezbollah to come charging in, and then they'll start their massacre again with these people, and then the United States will come in, and then we'll have a much, much wider war, won't we? And then what we're going to hear now from Peter Ford, former ambassador to Syria, and also deputy leader of George Galloway's Workers' Party, is that he thinks that there won't be much of a reaction at the moment, because they understand this. They don't want to be provoked by the Israelis, no matter what happens. That even if they're killing 100 civilians, they know that many thousands, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands would probably die if they responded as the Israelis want them to this provocation.
I too noticed the BBC's use of that neutral word, audacious. I think a better word would have been reckless. A better word would have been criminal. A better word would have been stupid. But no, BBC call it audacious, almost praiseworthy, in fact, in BBC speak. And our government could not bring themselves to utter a word of criticism of that assassination, that murder, or indeed any Israeli actions. In recent days, they have been hovering on the brink of expressing some mild criticism of Israel, particularly after the slaughter of innocents a few days ago in a school in Gaza, when probably over 100 people, most of them children, were killed. But they play with words in the Foreign Office way with which I'm very familiar. So the Foreign Office wouldn't actually condemn Israel. They condemned the loss of life. They condemned the tragic loss of life without saying who was the perpetrator. I used to be paid good money to come up with weasel words like that. I recognize it immediately. They're trying to throw sand in people's eyes, putting it about quietly that they are in practice limiting arms sales to Israel, but officially there's no change. And this is the key operative question at the moment for the British government. Will you, or are you, stopping arms sales to Israel, which are directly involved in the bombing by F-35 planes, which includes about 15% British component? Will they institute immediately no more shilly-shallying, an arms embargo? And the current answer is no, and they're getting away with it. So they're sending, as a substitute for real action, they're sending the ridiculous foreign the man masquerading as Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, sending him hotfoot to meet Netanyahu in the next couple of days. It's grotesque, this posturing, this pretending to take action when real action, an arms embargo, is taken off the table. In the same way that the Americans tut-tut about the latest Israeli excesses, and then in the next breath they announce $20 billion worth of arms sales to Israel over the coming years. If they think they're fooling anyone with this, I don't know what universe they're in.
Senator, the former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain, Peter Ford, there speaking to me earlier this week about the situation with Lammy's visit, particularly and specifically the actions of the Israelis, the assassination over in Tehran the other week of the chief negotiator. It couldn't be a clearer sign to the world, Martin, with that one, could it, that the Israeli government, as it's presently constituted, is absolutely no interest whatsoever in ending this?
Well, that's right. And at that point, ultimately, you have to go to war. It's very unfortunate, but that's what I'm afraid. Medvedev, who's the vice president in, used to be the president in Russia, he's saying, well, there's only one solution here. It's a major war. I'm afraid that's where we're at now. They've just got to be defeated. The Israelis and their allies have to be defeated. There's nothing else to do. And the quicker it's done, the more Gazans will be saved. They need to be hitting Israeli forces surrounding Gaza. They can't attack Gaza directly because they're going to kill civilians if they do. But they must have bases not far away. They've been moving forces from Gaza up to the north to try and get them closer to Hezbollah. But, I mean, you've got the Russian Air Force based in Syria. And, of course, the Israelis have not been fighting in the Ukraine for the last 3 or 4 years. The last big war they had was in 1973, and they don't know anything about how to fight a modern war, where you can't actually gather a big attacking force together because it gets mashed up straight away by directed missile strikes. They've never fought such a war. Maybe they need to fight one, and it needs to be quick, and it needs to be determined. That's me talking. What do I know? I mean, I'm not a pacifist, but I'm not a military leader, but you're neither.
Well, no, no one's pretending we are. What do you mean?
No, well, I'm just saying what I would like to see happen here now, from my point of view, is that the axis of resistance needs to get very serious about whacking the Israeli army out of existence so they can't do this.
Yeah, but they won't do that, will they? Because the Americans will come running to their assistance, won't they?
Well, in that case, if the Americans and the British join and then sink their aircraft carriers, do it. The Russians, I mean, can
you not see how this would be just playing into the Israeli hands?
Well, it would be in one way, Tony, They could start to use nuclear weapons, but maybe we need British commandos to go in there and seize their nuclear weapons. I don't know. We're fighting on the wrong side. If Akrotiri base was being used to put in a no-fly zone over Gaza, that would be a useful use for our base. That's what we used it for in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. That's what we used it for in Serbia to overthrow Milosevic. Why don't we use it, the same base, to overthrow Netanyahu? But of course we don't do that because we're on his side. He's a bigger mass murderer, far bigger mass murderer than either Gaddafi or Milosevic.
We were talking about Palestine Action and the Solidarity Campaign earlier, but something I'd not heard about is a group called Youth Demand. They're a pro-Palestinian protest group, but they're for young people. They had got together to disrupt the state opening of Parliament few weeks ago, appear to have been thwarted by Scotland Yard. So they're not even allowed to do anything, these people. Apparently, dozens of members, this is from a month or so ago, dozens of members of the pro-Palestine protest group Youth Demand were arrested by police as part of the Met's policing of the King's speech. Well, it's going back to good old Tampon Charlie again. The article goes on to explain that these people didn't even get anywhere near the Houses of Parliament and the parade at the King goes down the mall in his coach, etc. As soon as they got their banners, like starting to get them ready, they're surrounded by police and all arrested. Doesn't sound like there is actually a right to protest in this country, particularly under this new King.
Well, that's right. And of course, our taxes are paying for the police to do that. And our taxes are also paying for these children to be killed. And ultimately, of course, Britain and its leadership are complicit in all of this. And if we're going to have war crimes tribunals, all of them will have to stand trial. If we're going to put Russian generals on trial, we've got to put British generals on trial. And that's got to be, it's got to be absolutely clear. War crimes are war crimes. Everybody gets treated the same. Otherwise, let's not bother with the war crimes trials. Let's just get on with the killing.
Now,
and don't, no crime for mummies.
I had to correct last week. I wrongly said that I thought Nick Griffin had gone to my school, Langley Park School, which I went to secondary school many years ago. It's not him. It was actually a guy called John Tyndall, who was far more fanatical even than Nick Griffin, who was the former leader of the BNP. Anyway, he fell out with the BNP. And he was talking to one of these interviewers. I mean, I don't want to make a habit of putting Nick Griffin on here, Martin, but he's got some interesting things to say now to Syrian Girl this week about the Israel lobby lobbying the BNP. And one of the reasons he was pushed out, because he was saying, no, we're not going to be just a pro-Israel group.
What are your thoughts on what's been currently happening?
Well, it's been a long time building up. The media in Britain, I guess all over the world, are saying, oh, it's all created by the fake information that the murder of three little girls in Southport was by a Muslim when it wasn't. That rumour, fake news, did help to spark the initial trouble in Southport, but it's nothing to do with what's happened since. This is quite simply the British people at the end of their tether, and something has finally snapped. The deepest reason for this is that the mass immigration policies forced on the British people by successive governments, the political elite were given a very, very clear message by the Brexit vote. That was overwhelmingly get control of our borders, stop the transformation of our country. That was the instruction the British people, the biggest popular mandate in British electoral history, gave to the British political elite, change what you're doing. And they threw that back at us and they spat in our face as well. So the people are really to blame. There's other factors which we'll come on to. But in the end, the people to blame for this trouble are the political elite for treating the British people, especially the white working class, with utter contempt.
Basically, you voted for Brexit, I think it was in 2016. Mm-hmm. And yet nothing has developed on that front.
Nothing's changed. Well, in fact, it got worse, because although the British people clearly, and everyone accepts, voted for Brexit overwhelmingly over the immigration issue, the politicians' response basically was to say, well, OK, now we're leaving Europe, so we're not going to bring over Poles and Romanians anymore, but you're going to get more Africans, more Pakistanis and more Indians. So it was really a mockery, and a very cynical and brutal mockery of the British people.
Why do you think that they're doing this? I mean, how is it in their interest to do this?
Oh, that's a huge thing. It's a combination of capitalism needs cheap labour. politicians, especially Labour people, want cheap votes. The far left wanted mass immigration because it's the best way to destabilize the country and build a revolution. The cultural Marxists want to use it as a battering ram against Christian civilization, and the anti-Christian, anti-white Talmudists quite openly want to use mass immigration to breed us out of existence. You put all those things together and you've got an elite which is hell-bent. It's not just Britain, obviously. Across the whole of the white world, there's an elite which is hell-bent on getting rid of the people who actually pay their salaries.
Also, I'm going to play a clip where you told us that, you know, during your party when you were like on the rise, they asked you to stay clear of any issue other than the Islam issue.
Yes, indeed.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, again, I hope we can do this again, and I hope we can get your Twitter account back.
So. Yes.
Pleasure.
Great talking to you again.
Let's find a solution. Okay, bye.
And as you know, over the last couple of years, there's been an immense amount of effort thrown at this party and the key individuals in this party, at various local as well as national levels, to take us out of the field. Out of all the groups, the most important one by a mile was the English Defence League, British Freedom Party. That was a serious, systematic, hugely funded effort by a section of the ruling elite, by this Zionist neocon clique, to dominate, to simply take over nationalism and turn it into their tool to encourage the white working class to go and fight their wars, and so that when the banking collapse comes, people are looking in the wrong direction instead of the real culprits. This party, we were approached. I was approached. We were offered money from the United States, and all they wanted was two things. They only wanted us to concentrate on Islam, and I yield to no one in my criticism of Islam and grooming. I put my neck on the line. Many of you have put your neck on the line as well. But it's not the only problem. And they wanted us only to focus on that, and it only came with one other thing. They wanted us to drop our criticism of the banking system. Those were the only two things. We had to concentrate on talking about Muslims, and we had to drop our criticism of the international banking system. And I refused, and we refused. That was in about 2007. And all hell broke loose, really, from that time, when systematically they tried to take this party apart. And there's the self-same people in groups, various of the so-called Tory think tank groups and so on, things like Policy Exchange, things like the Centre for Policy Studies, the self-same people who organised and ran Nothing British to devastate the BNP's electoral chances with lies in the sun and things like that. Those self-same people were there right at the start conspiring to create the English Defence League, then the British Freedom Party, to take real nationalism in this country and break it on the wheel and then replace it by their puppet.
Martin, he's saying a lot of nonsense there, but of course there are always some interesting little things people like this come out with. In fact, you know, it's pernicious racist nonsense, some of it. But what he's talking about, the Zionist lobby, is really interesting. I mean, he's saying around about 2008, there was a massive battle going on within the BNP, the British National Party, the far-right British Party, racists, because there were Israelis that were saying to them, look, you know, you're going to have to take the line that the Muslims are the real problem. Otherwise, we're going to destroy you. And they attempted to do. And of course, he was eventually kicked out because he was saying, no, we shouldn't be taking this money from the Zionist lobby.
As you say, a lot of pernicious racist rubbish.
This whole idea of the BNP actually being hijacked by the Zionist lobby to become an anti-Muslim party.
Yes, they've done a very good job of that. You will find that the right wing across Europe are now firmly behind the Israelis. Tommy Robinson himself has been in the Golan Heights brandishing an Uzi submachine gun. The Golan Heights, which actually belongs to Syria, doesn't belong to the Israelis. And in actual fact, the Israelis have turned up in the Middle East and said they're taking it over. They haven't come on rubber dinghies. They've come with F-16s and tanks. And of course, this whole thing about there was more immigration coming into our country, that's because the British and the Americans forced the EU to move the EU border much more quickly than other countries in the EU wanted, right up to the Russian border, because it's all about American power and Israeli power on a global level. That's why we've had more immigration. because the British pushed the EU to open the doors by allowing all these countries quickly into the EU. As an economist, I have to tell you, I worked in Poland in the 1980s. Serious people didn't want to join the EU because you've got to wait until you're ready and you're and you've got the right sort
okay,
of...
Okay, so anyway, let's can we just get back to Palestine, please, and get back to the Zionist lobby? We've got a couple of clips. We've got a couple of
let's
clips.
Let's get back to reality.
Okay, so... Palestinians, I think it's fascinating to hear Griffin talking about the Israel lobby taking over his party back
in... Griffin or was that Tyndall?
That's Griffin.
That's Griffin, okay.
Yeah, anyway, so I will add that onto the podcast because I was supposed to be in that clip and it didn't pop up. I must have somehow saved the wrong part of the clip or something. Sorry about that, folks. Anyway, look, we're going to have a listen now to a couple of, to wind up, a couple of clips which are much more sort of bigger picture ones. First of all, this chappie is called Thomas Suarez, talking about how the Palestinians aren't actually refugees. They are there in internment camps.
A refugee camp is a camp for people displaced by war or natural disaster, on account of which are unable to return home. So even during 1948, this terminology was a bit of a stretch. But by early 1949 at the latest, the terms refugee and refugee camp were patently wrong. The displaced Palestinians were perfectly able to go home. They were no longer refugees if the term ever applied at all. Yet they remained in camps, dying from cold, hunger, and disease. Why? The single reason they remained in camps then, and the sole reason they remain in camps today, is that the Israeli state blocks them from going home because they are not Jewish. End of story. So these are not refugees and refugee camps. They are interned people and internment camps. They are Israeli internment camps for Palestinian non-Jews, paid for by the same international community that now pays for their genocide. The refugee terminology instead makes Israel's blocking people from their own homes sound like some tragedy of history for which no one is to blame and about which nothing can be done. And I am not nitpicking semantics.
You recently equated...
A refugee camp is a camp for people displaced by...
Sorry about that. So Thomas Suarez there talking about them. Do you think the terminology is quite important, isn't it? He's talking about internment camps. I would call them concentration camps, really. But he's saying that the world is being told that they're just refugees.
Well, the United Nations UNRWA, which of course the Israelis want to destroy, is based on the idea that they are refugees. And I take the point that they're not refugees. These people have been pushed into camps in Damascus, in Lebanon, and they can't leave those camps. And, of course, that's where the Sabra and Shatila massacres happened in the 1980s, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon and sent the phalangists in there to kill the Palestinians in these camps. They can't leave these camps. Of course, there are refugees from Syria because we tried to overthrow the Assad government and lots of people fled from that. And, of course, that's one of the things that Nick Griffin and other people need to understand. If you destroy Libya, Syria, Iraq, that's not very far away, much closer than the United States. And so is Ukraine, much closer than the United States.
Those refugees might go to Turkey or something. Anyway, look, there's also Ilan Pape's book. There's Ilan Pape's book, which someone sent me in a couple of weeks ago. I don't know how I managed to not let you have it. And this is amazing. This is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, his recent book out. Pretty much everyone sensible is reading. And Max Blumenthal interviewed him about it a couple of weeks ago.
From the Palestinian perspective, this international alliance is terror, is terrorism against them. It's meant to intimidate them, to terrorize them, and eliminate them. A pro-Zionist Jewish lobby emerged in America already in 1918. By the time the Second World War ended, it became already a powerful lobby by itself, joined by a Christian Zionist lobby. And these are lobbies that existed already from, if we look at them today, you can say that they are more than 100 years old. which this longevity explains also their power and the inertia that everybody obeys them, even without their need to exert pressure. Now, if you add to this in modern time, not just the power of the United States, but the interests of multinational corporation, the high-tech industry, the military industry, the securitization industry, you can see that this global coalition continues, and this time is not just complicit in the elimination itself. Far more important, it's complicit by providing immunity and a shield for the one power that precisely does the elimination itself, which is the state of Israel. And part of this kind of elimination in our time, apart from the horrific genocide that we are witnessing, is trying to suppress and silence any attempt to show this complicity, any attempt to show the essence of Zionism, the dehumanization of Zionism, to protect this charade, fabricated charade and narrative that actually here you have a civilized democratic state that doing self-defense, and the collateral damage is the elimination of the Palestinians. And in order to protect that narrative, you want to silence, whether it's to try to silence me in the United States, or to silence Max, or to silence any one of us. And what is so absurd, and with this I will come to a conclusion, what is so absurd that while we are watching daily on our small screen and big screen the genocide in Palestine, this attempt to justify the global coalition that enables that kind of genocide and enabled the genocide before and the ethnic cleansing before, that coalition still works. Still is at work despite everything that one can see for themselves and are either surprised or not surprised, I don't know, that still there are young people with modicum of decency in them who would build encampments on university campuses, other people who would go in masses to demonstration, and many of them would be Jews as well as Muslims and Christians. It is still surprising that there is still the sense among those who are part of that global Israel coalition that they can still convey their destructive support for the destruction of the Palestinian through a discourse of democracy, civilization, self-defense, and so on. The gap between the way they talk about the reality and the reality itself has never been wider. And I think that we should tell them that we are thinking about their action as not only immoral, but also as actions of terrorism. And instead of defending ourselves from accusation, as I was accused in Detroit of supporting terror, I try to give those who question me a short lesson in history, which was not a very good one because I was very tired after 8 years in economy class from London. But as much as I could, I told them, do you think that supporting the Palestinian is supporting terror? Think about what does it mean to support Israel? That is supporting terror. You just got it wrong. Needless to say, that didn't help to shorten the interrogation. It prolonged it. But the point is that we are on the right side of history, and using the right language and expanding the definition of state terror and explaining that Palestine, of course, it's not the only place where it happened, but it epitomizes the hypocrisy and double talk of a case study that is 120 years old, in which with the power of the West, a pastoral people were denied their natural and normal existence. And it's unbelievable that they are still there. It shows their resilience. It shows their solidarity. And this is not because the Arab world was particularly helpful, not because the Muslim world was particularly helpful, not because anyone in the world was particularly helpful. This is because of the particular DNA the Palestinians have in their attachment to the land, attachment to their tradition, to their religion, to the area. But with our help, their efforts in the past should be will be more successful in the future. Thank you.
Martin, Ilan Pappe's done a pretty amazing job. His book is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He himself, of course, is basically a Jewish exile here. He was having all sorts of trouble over in Israel, so he came over here something like 20 years ago.
Yes, well, I mean, he's one of the good Israelis, like there were good Germans. There we are. We're on the cusp of goodness knows what's coming next. You know, it's very hard not to get very emotional about this because all of our lives are on the line here. We could end up with a nuclear war as a result of all of this, and it's going to make climate change look like a hiccup. But nevertheless, most people are still totally unaware of how close we are to the edge here. Very close. And we're very close because we've stupidly allowed ourselves to get to this position.
Well, I don't think it's stupidity. I think it's a vice-like control by a tiny clique on some of these major elite institutions. And, of course, the Bilderbergers and NATO have made sure of all of that. Our final clip tonight is from a woman called Anya Parampil. I'll put a link, by the way, to Ilan Pappe's book up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of course. She is on Judge Neapolitano's Judging Freedom, or was a few weeks ago, asking, where are the Nazis today?
You recently equated NATO and Israel, and the common point was Nazism. Did I get that correctly? And if so, would you explain, please? You know how much I think of your intellect and your courage. This one I'm dying to hear.
So this is a tricky one to unpack because there are a couple of ways you could interpret it. There's just the obvious way, which is, well, after World War II, it's well known through Operation Paperclip that Nazis were rehabilitated and absorbed in the U.S. government, namely to establish NASA. And I think that's a chapter in history that we should revisit because I don't totally understand it myself. And I don't think there's been a lot of discussion as to why that happened. But that's not really the case that I was making. What I was thinking when I put that tweet out there is that I was watching the D-Day celebration, watching Biden turning around away from the cameras next to Macron, a lifetime banker. And that's basically the only mark on his resume that got him into the French presidency, and looking at these two celebrating the defeat of fascism and kind of scratching my head because it's 2024 and it feels to me as if fascism is alive and well. And because Nazi Germany was defeated in World War II, that term Nazi kind of became the label that we use for anything that is fascist. In reality, the fascist ideology that we are taught, the Nazis, was the heart of Nazi of the Nazi Party, is today I see it playing out in Israel, where there is a government that has declared that its ethno-religious ideology gives it the right to eradicate an entire population of people, other human beings living in Gaza. So I see a direct line between Zionist ideology and what we are told about Nazi ideology. Not to mention the fact that on the other side of this war in Europe, we have actual Nazi brigades fighting in the Ukrainian military alongside conscripted Ukrainian soldiers that are forced to fight, dragged into buses and into vans and forced to fight a Russian menace. And the Russians were apparently our allies in World War II. So why are we now still fighting them? And you have Macron standing there before the world celebrating the end of fascism, while just weeks ago he was saying he's willing to commit French troops to go die in this war against Russia. How many Ukrainian civilians, Ukrainian conscripted soldiers, how many Russian soldiers have died in this war? How many Palestinians have died over the past 8 months? At what point do we step back and say that the same forces that we allegedly defeated, or this evil that we defeated during World War II, is still staring us straight in the face? Not to mention the fact that since the end of World War II, when this new international order, whether it's the financial order in the IMF and the World Bank or the political order established through the United Nations, that actually resulted in a very violent decades of war. Immediately in Korea, there was a UN-US campaign to force Korea into this world order, this financial world order, that resulted in the deaths of 20% of the Korean population, the destruction of their entire infrastructure. I've been to Korea and interviewed, spoken with people still reeling from the effects of that war in the 50s. That came right after the so-called defeat of fascism. What about Cambodia? What about Vietnam? It seems that there was actually a march, a fascist march, to continue to push people around the world to participate in a global financial economy based in Europe and the United States by any means necessary, mostly through death. That's the world that we've lived in since World War II. So I just feel like in 2024, I was kind of over the celebration of the defeat of fascism, because if that was the defeat of fascism, then I'm not sure what we ended up with is honestly that much better. And I'm speaking as an American as well, because there's a lot of talk about Americans having won World War II, but that's not really how I feel. I feel that we got nice perks for a while in terms of the economy, but ultimately what we're left with in 2024 is an economy based on death. Our economy cannot function without these wars, without printing money to buy weapons and then sell them to our friends or subsidize them to our allies. And then, such as in Ukraine or Israel, and we have, you know, members of Congress crying because they can't get weapons passed, saying that their constituents won't be able to pay for daycare if these funding bills for weapons don't go through. I mean, what kind of economy and world is that? The reality is Americans have suffered under this. We've provided the tax money. We've provided the boys and girls that have fought in these wars for decades. So I'm just tired of hearing that we won, to be honest. That was my statement.
Anya Parampil there speaking to Judge Neapolitano. And of course, this chimes in with our work and my book, Martin, about the Fourth Reich being created by Bormann and Morton during World War II, manifesting itself in these Bilderberg conferences.
Well, I mean, you could see it on two levels. One is, this is very, you know, the Nazism and fascism of capitalism and its final incarnation is as bad now as it was in the 30s, but it's also because the actual personnel are the same. You know, we actually recruited a lot of Nazis. I mean, very few Japanese were punished. The Japanese have been in control of Korea since 1905, and of course it was the Communist Party that had led the rebellion against them. But when the war ended, the West just came in and said, we're taking over here. And, of course, the Japanese have been in charge since 1905. And Vietnam, they've been in charge since 1940. The French were in charge before that. Then the French reappeared and said to the Vietnamese, no, you've got to do what we want.
Yeah, it seems to me pretty simple that the generation that can remember the Second World War is dying off. Very, very few, only a handful of them left. Then it's time to sort of for this all to resurge again.
Well, I mean, she mentioned the D-Day landings there and the celebrate, you know, the commemoration of them. A few years ago, Putin was invited to that, and he got together with Angela Merkel and the then president of France, Hollande. And he said, look, why don't we get together and try and sort this business out in the Ukraine? Why don't we go to Minsk and we'll set up what's called the Normandy Four? And they got together and they came up with a plan to end the war in the Ukraine. And Russia signed up to that along with the Germans and the French. And the whole point of it was to keep the British and the Americans and the Germans, the rest of them, out of it, the Anglos. But, of course, it turned out that was just a cheat, as both Merkel and Hollande subsequently said, well, we were lying.
Can I ask you what you make of this sort of big question of the week, which is, if this is the last gasp in Ukraine, are we looking at something to ignite a much bigger war in the Middle East?
Well, it's not really necessarily up to some great power to decide all of this. The run-up to World War One, everybody, even as it came along, they were thinking, well, they had telegraphs in those days.
Can you just answer, like, basically yes or no?
We're about to have a big war. That's what Medvedev has said. In actual fact, it's about time we had a big war, Tony, but the West must lose, and they must lose quickly. And that means that the Russian, I mean, in Russia, Putin is under pressure. Finish them off now. Finish them off. That's the pressure he's coming under from the opposition. That's the real world. Somebody should tell Keir Starmer.
Yes, right. Anyway, we're finishing this week with a ode from Patrizia Opulenza, which is about, well, you can work it out for yourself, the Games of Honour, it says here. The Olympics is over. Yikes, what a disgrace. Debauchery, tomfoolery and punches in face. Inversion conversions wherever we look to ceremony perverted, come hook or by crook. Chromosomes don't lie, regardless of breasts. Dresses or makeup, regardless of tests. Gender is gender, regardless of woke. A woman is a woman and a man is a bloke. The return match is here. These para games will begin. The Paralympics, where the aim is to win. 11 days of wonder, 1,000 torchbearers au fait. Pass the flame around in relay for 4 days, come what may. 4,400 will compete in these games. Events, 548 with lots of spare change. Games of endurance, of strength and goodwill. Feats of raw passion, competition and skill. Years of hard training on finish lines will stand. Medals plus honour for each woman and each man. The Paralympics from impossible to possible. I can. Thank you very much, Patrizia. Yes, I do much prefer the Paralympics to the actual Olympics themselves. It sounds like you do. Time to sign off now. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Warren Thornton, and also to Martin Smith, we heard on the show earlier on, and, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you dare. Do please send me interviews and story tips on Not the BCFM Politics Show page. You can comment there, and the comments were stored up for a few weeks, but I managed to pop lot them through last week. I don't know why it started storing. Anyway, this is the way this tech works. Sometimes you think it's going to do something, it does something else. Anyway, you'll also find the podcast, full length interview, story tips and comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter if you can afford it. You can also donate or set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week here on the talkradio.org.uk stream, over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Do please make live recordings. So we've been streaming live in the East Stone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. RadioSoapbox.com decided they're not going to stream us anymore. I was in touch with the chap I interviewed last week, and I was saying, well, it doesn't make any sense because this is being run by you from here in Worthing, and yet it's just because your server is over in Wisconsin. I'd like to, anyway, he just decided, no, I'm not going to discuss this anymore, so we're not on that one. So that's radiosoapbox.com for you. Maybe a good parting company for a while. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend away from the Empire of Lies. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Oh, Sister Josephine, what do all these policemen mean by coming to the convent in a grim limousine after Sister Josephine? While you, Sister Josephine, you sit with your boots up on the altar screen, you smoke one last cigar. What a funny nun you are. The policemen say that Josephine's a burglar in disguise, big bad Norman, 15 years on the run. The sisters disbelieve it, no, that can't be Josephine. Just think about her tenderness towards the younger nuns. Oh, Sister Josephine, they're searching the chapel where you've been seen, the nooks and the crannies of the nuns' canteen, after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you sip one farewell Benedictine before your au revoir. A right funny nun you are. Admittedly, her hands are big and hairy and embellished with a curious tattoo. Admittedly, her voice is on the deep side, and she seems to shave more often than the other sisters do. Oh, Sister Josephine, founder of the convent pontoon team, they're looking through your bundles of rare magazines after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you give a goodbye sniff of Benzedrine to the convent budgeriga. A bloody funny nun you are. No longer will her snores ring through the chapel during prayers, nor her lustful moanings fill the stilly night. No more empty bottles of altar wine come clunking from her cell. No longer will the cloister toilet seat stand upright. Oh, Sister Josephine, slipping through their fingers like Vaseline, leaving them to clutch your empty crinoline. After Sister Josephine, while you, Sister Josephine, sprinting through the suburbs when last seen, dressed only in your wimple and your rosary, a right funny nun you seem to be.
And I cannot find none, and sing, oh, Castleford ladies' magical circle meets tonight in an upstairs aspidistra room that's lit by candlelight, where Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies practice every week unspeakable pagan rites. Dressed in their Sunday coats and their flowerpot hats, respectable middle-aged ladies running to fat at that. There's Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies, each with a Woolworth's broomstick and a tabby cat. But they don't waste time with a Ouija board or a seance now and again. No, none of your wittering, twittering, petty poltergeists for them. No, Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies prefer to be tickled by the whiskery chins of bogeymen. Their husbands potter at snooker down the club, unaware of the devilish jiggery poke and rub-a-dub-dub, while Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies are frantically dancing naked for Beelzebub. And after the witch's picnic and the devil's grog, after their savage pantings, their hysterical leapfrog, well, Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies go back home for cocoa and the epilogue. So, be careful how you go of a Saturday night. If you see a little old lady passing by, it very well might be Elizabeth Jones or Lily O'Grady, or one of those satanical ladies. Their eyes are wild and bright, their cheekbones all alight. Don't go where they invite, because the Castleford ladies' magical circle meets tonight.
Thank you. across the world. Now you're feeling good. Go out there and knock 'em silly, girl. Go out there, show 'em how to thrill. Go out there, show. Pretty as you feel. Say, you're only pretty as you feel.
Pretty mama.